That'd be great if someone would submit a like weird old game titles. And like if we play Balderdash, where we all like one of us knows what it is, but the rest all just make it up, and we have people in the audience try to vote on which one is the real explanation. That might be good. Yeah, that's right. We'll have prizes. All right, guys, let's clap. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. What up, y'all? This is Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette.
Ready and willing.
James Jones.
Hi.
And that pregnant pause means that Mr. John Lindemann has returned.
Boy, you should have known by now. Lindy does it.
No.
Welcome to the ATL. Welcome back.
Southern no. style, baby.
Get out.
This is Southern Fried RFN. Go ahead. Go ahead, Johnny. Go ahead, Johnny. Give me your best shot.
So, John, all your shit finally showed up.
Yes. Yeah, all my stuff finally showed up after 2 weeks and several thousand dollars. Yes, my stuff finally showed up. We're still looking for one. There was actually one box that didn't make it here, and that was the box with pretty much all of my shirts, my suits, all my sports stuff, sports jerseys
John
and shit.
John hasn't worn any clothes for 14 days.
Yeah, I'm pretty much on my backup wardrobe, but you know what? People just don't seem to really notice, so I don't know what that tells you.
Surely that box was put on the same truck as all the other boxes that did show up.
Yes, it was. But see, the catch is, Johnny, the catch is, and we didn't know this beforehand. Because we went through kind of a third-party sort of contractor. It was a bad choice. But what they did is they switched trucks. So one company picked our stuff up and then gave it to another company who put it on their truck and then brought our stuff down and dropped it off.
Yeah, so that's pretty normal.
That's a recipe for disaster.
It was a bad call. It was a bad call.
Oh, man. That sucks. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, you know.
So you had a rough move, and I know you haven't had a whole lot of time to play games with all the craziness going on, starting a new job. Mm-hmm. Moving across the country and not having all your gear set up. But I know you got to play some handheld games. So
I did.
We're going to get to that in just a sec. I just also wanted to let people know that in the second part of this show, we're probably going to talk about some of the recent things that have been going down that you might have heard of just for a few minutes. And then we're going to wrap up Retroactive with Ease Book 2. So please look forward to that. And now we're moving onward to new business. And of course, John is first. Because he's got some catching up to do.
Yeah, a little bit of catching up to do. I really haven't done much console gaming at all for probably
ever
for probably 3 weeks now.
Well, you haven't had a TV.
Yeah, well, I hook everything up. I mean, I haven't had my Wii hooked up for weeks and weeks,
years.
but yeah, so console gaming has pretty much been off the table entirely. So I've been able to do some portable gaming, which was good because I was able to spend some time with the 3DS, and the game I got, of course, it's funny because I figured I got it right around PAX because, you know, I always have to buy some random 3DS game around PAX. It's just every year I feel like I have to do this now just because, you know, whatever game's hot at the time. I don't know. I just get that itch because I see everybody on Twitter.
You should see a doctor.
You know, I probably for that and many other things, but so
I love that you're excusing your selection here by calling it random.
Well, it's not random. I mean that in the sense that I really didn't anticipate buying it. I was kind of like, ah, you know, I'm just gonna let this one pass. But anyways, long story short, or short story long, which is what I'm doing. Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate is what I picked up for 3DS, and along with it, I got a Circle Pad Pro. Because I figured that was the only way to do it.
And it's literally the only way to do it, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing. It did not disappoint because, you know, anybody that's played Monster Hunter Tri, I mean, you pretty much know the game. It's very, very similar. They've added, you know, some new monsters, and I think they've added a new area as well. But, you know, the areas aren't really, you know, too crazy anyways. You kind of know what you're getting with Monster Hunter. You know, you're getting some sort of scenic sort of area that you kind of play around in and fight these huge monsters in. But really, the main thing was I was curious to see how it played with the Circle Pad Pro, and the what the Circle Pad Pro lets you do is really play it like the Wii version, which is really good. I thought the Wii version really controlled well. And the Circle Pad Pro with the second analog stick or circle pad, it really lets you control the camera separately while you're moving around, which really helps when you're doing stuff like kind of circle strafing monsters. Really, really helps. Comes in really handy. And if you don't use the circle pad, you wind up using the D-pad to move the camera, which is awkward because you have to keep – because you move around with the left circle pad, and then you have to keep taking your thumb off of it to move the camera. So you run into – it's more of a PSP-style sort of – move, hit the camera, move, hit the camera, move, hit the camera kind of thing.
I don't see is what it? The problem is. Just use your second left thumb.
Some people do the claw, where they end up using their index finger or their middle finger to do one of those, and it looks bizarre. But doesn't the 3DS version of this also have like a touchscreen mode where you can use a stylus swipe with your thumb every now and then on the touchscreen to like swivel the camera around?
Yeah, one of the cool things they've added is on the touchscreen you can they have panels that allow you to they're kind of like hot buttons. So you can touch a certain part of the panel of the touchscreen and bring up your inventory instead of having to do it the kind of awkward way that you typically do it, which is holding down left and then scrolling through with the buttons. But see, that's the way I do it just because I'm old school PSP. I'm actually used to the crappy control scheme. So that's just how I play it, you know?
John is Stockholm Syndrome for this game.
Yeah, it's pretty much. I mean, that's just
You're
how
part
I play
of the problem.
It. Yeah, I really am. So, I don't really need any of that. It actually kind of confuses me, but, having to even bother with the touchscreen. But the one key thing, though, that they have added is a target frame that you can add on there. And what it does is it locks on to whatever monster you're facing. So if you happen to – and this is really more geared towards people that don't have the Circle Pad Pro that might have a harder time swapping the camera around, so to get a look at the monster once they kind of, evade or do something like that. And you can tap the panel and it'll lock your character back onto the monster. So you can automatically – so even though you have the choice of – controlling the camera with the D-pad, but then also I think you can hit the left button and you can bring the camera directly back behind your character. You now have the third option of hitting this panel on the touchscreen and locking onto the monster. So you're facing the monster at all times.
Okay. But it won't stay that way, right? Like once you swivel the camera around to face the monster, then it's freed up again?
Yeah, I don't think so. That's the thing. Like I said, I haven't really played with it too much.
Does it stay locked on?
I don't know. I don't know if it actually stays locked on because I really haven't had to use it because I've just been using the Circle Pad Pro.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't really have a need for the feature. But definitely,
nobody needs a lock-on system.
I would think, this is just my guess, but my guess is that it would not lock on because they would probably think that would make it too easy for you to just sit there and circle straight for the monster.
I think you can lock on the Wii U game. I believe you can.
I don't remember. Right. I didn't play enough of it.
I don't think so.
I think it's kind of a loose lock-on, though.
Yeah. So I think you can target the monster, and it will like put a reticle over it, and your attacks will maybe always go in that direction towards the monster, but the camera still remains independent.
Yeah,
that's kind of how I remember it.
Yeah.
The combat in the game is just complicated. Which is why people love it, and it's why people hate it, right?
Yeah, it's very complicated, and this game really this version of it really doesn't do much more to bring you into the game. I mean, it's again they teach you the game not through actually showing you how to do things, but rather hiding stuff in menus and text boxes and stuff like that.
Finding it hard to read the text? Because I've heard a lot of complaints about that on the 3DS version.
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult because there's a little bit of a shadow behind the text. It's kind of jarring at first. You get used to it, but it's a little bit weird. Yeah, it's I have to laugh because there's no real tutorial. They kind of have these sort of breadcrumb quests that sort of introduce you, over time to the different concepts of the game, but there really is nothing sitting you down and telling you, okay, this is why you're doing this. Like, there's no, they don't explain the broad concept of the game to you. They say, hey, go out and pick up this stuff. And they don't tell you really why you're doing that or how that helps you. you know? Mm-hmm. And maybe they do, but you have to go into like your hunter's notes or something and you don't know where it is. What made me laugh, and I think this is kind of the game in a nutshell, is one of the early quests has you, it's trying to teach you how to combine, materials that you get and make a potion or something like that. So it says, okay, go out and get these two things. So you go out on the quest and you get the two things and you bring them back. And then, you know, you sort of have to figure out how to combine them yourself. But the funny thing is, I think there's actually a separate quest. There's no quest to tell you, okay, like there's nothing to tell you, okay, combine these things. Then once you do that and understand what it is, what you're doing, then you succeed. It's just get these things and, you know, you'll succeed the quest. You'll complete the quest. But they don't tell you actually what to do with the things. But once you figure that out, it's pretty funny because the first time I did that, you would think that it would be that, you know, it would be like 100% that you would create this new item. But of course, the first time I do it, it fails and it gives me trash. I was like,
so
nice.
So there's a probability mechanic as well?
Yep. Yep. So the first time you do it, so it's trying to like introduce you to this mechanic. And of course, the first time you do it right out of the gate, it fails. So you don't
How
even
hard
actually
would it have been for them to override that percentage the
exactly.
first time.
And it's like the simplest potion in the game. I mean, there's you know, that really doesn't even help you like down the line. It's so funny. I was like and really and the funniest thing too is I think the chance of it succeeding is like 95%, but I got that 5% the first time I did it in the game. I'm like, Monster Hunter, you suck. No wonder people hate this game. So funny.
But you love it. Now
I love it. I love it because I understand it, right? But I put the time in to actually understand, right. And I know what I'm doing. So,
you know, I was reading a really good blog by Patrick Klepek over at Giant Bomb about his experiences, and it's a very good critical analysis of someone who has now played enough of the game to appreciate it, like just like you do. Yep. He hasn't played nearly as much as you, John, but he really kind of said, "I'm going to climb this mountain, and I don't care how hard it is, and yep. I'm going to get to the top, and I'm going to find out what is this game really all about. Why do people like it?" Mm-hmm. And I respect that a lot because it doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun to me, but anyway, he wrote a good explanation later and to me, what it comes down to, and you should go read his article, of course, over at Giant yeah. Bomb, but what I got out of it is that as great as 8-4 might be in translating the menus and the story and the descriptions in this game, and I'm sure they do a great job. Because they love these games and they understand them. So I'm sure that they do a very faithful translation. But what Capcom really needs is to get someone to localize this game and to yeah. give them the freedom to actually move pieces of it around and rewrite entire and like actually have the ability to create new tutorial missions and new introduction stuff to the game
yep.
to help people. And I'm fine if they make it all skippable. Like if you've played Monster Hunter before, you don't have to do any of that shit. Just jump into it just like you normally would.
Yeah.
But they're not going to be able to significantly expand this game's audience in the West if they just keep releasing games over here. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, this game has a chance to be really popular here if they'll just put them out. Not only do they put them out, they're actually adding features. Like on the Wii game, they made the online play free and they added voice chat, which I think they added the voice chat again in the American version of the Wii U game. They've put some serious effort into trying to make the game better and trying to keep bringing it out so that there aren't these long gaps in between releases in the West. But they have to go one step farther and they have to actually find a way to make it more accessible for people.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
you can't just keep throwing it on the market and hope that people discover it by word of mouth, because they are, but at a very slow pace.
Is any of us like familiar enough with Dark Souls and games like that, like both Monster Hunter and Dark Souls, to understand why one of them, like both are pretty much impenetrable, as far as I can tell? You know, how come one caught on and the other didn't?
Part of it, well, because I haven't played Dark Souls, I have played Demon's Souls. And Demon's Souls, it's I think it's easier to grasp the controls. I think the controls
yes.
are just, I mean, it's ultimately you're. I mean, it's kind of like it's just pretty basic controls. It's basic hack and slash controls. You don't have the different types of, like, I play with a greatsword in Monster Hunter, and with that, there's a lot of timing involved. You have to learn the patterns of the monsters so that you can time So you have to time it so that when the monster attacks, you can roll to the side, and then before the monster recovers to hit you, you can get your shot in. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of timing involved, whereas you don't really have that in like Demon's Souls and Dark Souls. Pretty much the way monsters are attacking you, they'll only attack you one or two ways, so it's very easy to kind of avoid monsters. I mean, you get your butt kicked a lot, but you know, it's easier to digest. And it's easier to kind of anticipate what's going to happen. With Monster Hunter, that's a bit harder. Hunter, I feel like they give you a car that you don't know how to drive, and they don't tell you how to drive it, and they don't tell you where you're going. But you have this really nice car, but you kind of have to figure it out.
They also give the car three wheels, and the steering wheel is a square.
Well, it's like they tell you how to operate every single thing in the car, but they don't really tell you how to actually drive it. You have to figure that out yourself, which is a problem. So,
or why you're driving it.
Yeah, exactly, why you're driving it. I mean, really, the game is pretty simple. Really, all you're doing is you are just, you create new materials, and that lets you create new armor, new swords and stuff like that. And basically, that makes you stronger so you can go after bigger monsters. That's the game.
Yeah, the goals might be simple, but the process of getting from one step to the next is not very clear at all.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest problem.
There's a lot of meandering involved.
To me, the difference, my sense of it, although I've played very little of either, is that the Demon Souls and Dark Souls are intentionally mysterious and obscure because they want you to have the communal experience of figuring out how the things work in that game. In Monster Hunter, I think it has more to do with the legacy of just how many games there are in that series and how many fans there are. And I think it comes down to Capcom doesn't really need to go in and fiddle with it because they're going to sell so many copies no matter what they do.
And I think they're probably somewhat intimidated of making changes to it.
Quite possible.
I don't think Capcom knows why Monster Hunter was a huge success for them. And I mean, to an extent, they're probably just as mystified by it as we are.
It's a cultural fad, which is not to say it's not a good game. But I think in Japan, it's a cultural fad.
It's still a very esoteric game to become such a big hit.
See, yeah. The thing is, to me, it's not esoteric because it takes a game design that works, which is people sitting there and grinding out monsters, killing monsters to get better gear, which allows them to kill bigger monsters and better gear. And it's a gear treadmill. It's a gear treadmill that is used in Diablo. It's a gear treadmill that is used in World of Warcraft, that is used in Monster Hunter, that is used in most JRPGs.
See, it's not just the gear treadmill part, as you call it, that is mystifying, though. It's that the game succeeds even when it's got these things that don't make it very approachable.
Yeah, that's a lot of games out of Japan, though.
It is, but I mean, I'm very well versed in these ridiculous-ass Japanese games.
Yeah.
I've never had that kind of experience with any game that didn't make me want to shatter the disc.
Well, John, but one more point before we move on to the next person. I was very curious as to why you decided to get the 3DS version of this. Now, obviously, you don't have a Wii U yet.
Yeah.
I was wondering, I was kind of thinking this game coming out on Wii U might be the tipping point for you, but I know you've got a lot of other stuff going on in your life right now.
Yeah.
But the 3DS game is not online. So, of course, you can play local wireless on the 3DS version, but you probably don't have anyone to do that with, do you?
No.
So you're essentially playing this as a solo experience. I was curious that seemed appealing enough to you to go with that version rather than maybe wait until you had a Wii U.
Well, I enjoyed the PSP, you know, and the PSP one is in the same boat. I mean, Monster Hunter Freedom Unite, it's exactly the same. And, you know, the controls aren't nearly as good. And, I mean, I enjoyed that game. The controls aren't nearly as good, and it wasn't in 3D. I wanted to see it in 3D. I mean, I knew that I would get a certain level of enjoyment out of it, you know, because, and at some point, you know, I'll put it this way. There is a higher chance of me at some point encountering somebody with a 3DS with that game than there ever is finding anybody with a PSP with that game.
All right. So I'll go next, because I've got a brand new Wii U game. Believe it or not. I've been playing Need for Speed Most Wanted U, or as I shall henceforth refer to it, Must Wanted, because someone at EA said, well, Nintendo fans must wanted some Need for Speed, so here you go.
Wow, that joke took a long time to develop.
Da-da-da. It's a game that came out about 4 months ago, I guess, on other systems. So it's been a little bit of a wait, but not so bad. You know, it's not Mass Effect 3. It's not Batman Arkham City. It's certainly not Deus Ex. So it's still a relatively fresh game. It's a game that, you know, feels like its time has not totally moved on. And when I read the reports about all the improvements they were making to the Wii U version and how Criterion really felt this was the best version of the game and they were really taking it seriously and had given it their full attention the past few months. Now we'll see if they bring out a game this fall, then I'll know they were bullshitting because there's no way they were giving it their full attention for 4 or 5 months at the beginning of the year. But the other thing is, I love Criterion as a developer. I've been a fan of theirs since the first Burnout, which is a long time ago, which I played on GameCube, and Burnout 2 as well, which is really good. I felt the series was the best on Burnout 3, which unfortunately, in my mind, was a PS2 exclusive. And that was where they took it to a whole new level, and I thought it was, at the time, maybe one of my favorite racing games ever. Probably still is one of my favorite racing games. The last couple games they've done, you know, I had Hot Pursuit on my 360. I played it for, I don't know, 10 hours or something like that, a respectable amount, but I didn't get sucked into it the way I have some of their past games. And I think, you know, the Need for Speed license does not really do them very many favors. And that game was also very simple and arcadey. So it was almost all driving down narrow tracks that didn't really, you know, there weren't a whole lot of turns. It was mostly just kind of going down straightaways, avoiding cops. And every now and then they would make you turn. And it was so jarring and unexpected that it almost always made me crash. It felt like it didn't belong in the game. Every now and then they take you on this crazy intersection and you'd be chasing a guy and you'd have to, you know, the route would force you to go that way and you'd miss the turn because there's no way you would ever expect that. Like the game barely has a map. You know, it's not that kind of game. So it's just really weird that you'd be on essentially this racetrack, this point-to-point, like Cruising USA style track, and all of a sudden there's this giant left turn that you have to take or else you're going to lose that mission. It's really crazy. So Most Wanted takes it back to the more open world city like Burnout Paradise, which is not my favorite Burnout, but it's a very good one. And I think like Burnout Paradise, it takes a while to figure out the flow of the game because, you know, to their credit, they don't fill you with tutorial madness at the beginning. They don't fill you with a bunch of story because there is no story. You actually start the game already driving at speed. So from moment one, once the game finally loads up, you are already going 60 miles an hour in some crazy car and you're chasing someone or you're racing someone or you're being chased by the cops. I don't remember because it was so weird. I was like, what the hell? I'm already playing. Like there's no ramp up to it whatsoever. They just drop you right in and you're already going. And from there, it's kind of do whatever you want. It's open world to a fault, and I mean that to a fault because I think it's not necessarily a good thing, but they certainly do remove any kind of restrictions on you in terms of where you can go, what cars you can use. With the Wii U version, you can actually, if you've got the gamepad nearby, if you're not, like I've been playing with classic controller, but I have the gamepad nearby, I can just reach over and like change the, like turn off traffic. Just like almost break the game. You know, I don't think you can do that during a race because there's a leaderboard and they want to keep things fair. But when you're just driving around the city, you can just break the game basically. You can change cars anytime just by pushing on the D-pad. There is no character that you never get out of the car. You just drive up to the other car that you want. You know, you find cars like in parking lots all over the city. You drive up to it, you push X, now you've got that car. You go off and tear it up, mess it up really bad, and you drive through this kind of like drive-through auto repair shop, which I wish was a real thing. And then your car is magically a new color and it's all fixed up. The cops chase you for seemingly no reason whatsoever. If you just happen to drive by a cop, all of a sudden they're chasing you, which is actually really annoying if you're looking for things or if you're trying to get to a certain place. Yeah, oh, it's totally irritating. It's also very hard to shake the cops once they're following you, especially if you... if you don't take it seriously at first and get rid of the cop right away, then eventually you'll do something, you know, one of them will pull up in front and you'll hit it, and then all of a sudden your wanted level goes up to like 3 or 4, and all of a sudden it's a shitstorm manhunt, you know, and they're just all over you, and it's like, whoa, 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 I just want to go to the next race. I didn't sign up for this. I don't care about this. I don't want to get chased by the cops. Just let me turn this off, you know. And sometimes it takes a couple of minutes to lose them, or you have to wait for them to like crash into you so many times that you get so-called busted, which has no consequence whatsoever. It's just annoying. I mean, there's no point to it. It's exciting if you want to play that way. Like if you want to get chased by the cops and try to outsmart them and outrun them, it's fun to do. But my problem is it usually happens unintentionally when I'm playing, and I would rather just like, can I just go immune to this? Like, it's kind of stupid. I just want to go to a race.
Your car's not street legal, man. You're street legal.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. And that gets to my other kind of remark on it, which is that, you know, the physics, the speed of the game, the layouts are very good of the city. They're very much like Burnout Paradise. But it lacks some of the things that made Paradise as much fun as it was, because the, you know, the crash mechanics aren't nearly as good because you're driving these licensed cars, so they're not allowed to mess them up in the same way. So most of the crashes feel very inconsequential. The game is so fast because they put you in these supercars from the very first second, and the game is so fast that most of the cars have shitty turning because they're not made for turning at any speed other than like 200 miles per hour, right?
Right.
So if you're actually coming from a stop, or if you're just at a low speed because you came around a curve, they turn like shit.
Right.
And it's really hard to find a car that turns like any kind of normal car that you've ever driven or been inside of. So that's really irritating.
Fun fact for those of you who don't know about cars, they actually can turn faster at speed. It's yes. True, though. It's crazy.
Depends on how they're set up, but yeah. And, you know, ultimately, I feel like the races in the game and the level of mayhem that they can achieve is reduced by the fact that this is a Need for Speed game and not a Burnout game.
Mm.
And it's too bad, but, you know, it is what it is, I guess. I mean,
it's somewhat just understandable. I mean,
it is understandable. I wish they would just make a Burnout game. I guess that's what it comes down to. But, you know, this is Need for Speed. I bought this because it's a Criterion game, not because it's a Need for Speed game. And most of the things about it that make it Need for Speed, I just find kind of stupid. But I'm willing to tolerate them because the driving is really fun, especially when you find a car that you like and that you can kind of get used to. It's very addictive. And the all the leaderboard stuff is implemented really well, you know. So I have lots of Wii U friends because of the podcast, and so my leaderboards are all very full with all kinds of people, you know. Some of them good friends, some of them people from the staff, some of them just, you know, listeners, people I know from Twitter or forums or whatever. And everything you do has a leaderboard in this game, and they're very good about showing them to you and giving you points for placing on the leaderboard, like points within your game that help you unlock more cars and more events. So it feels like everything you do, no matter how seemingly random or chaotic or non-productive, will move you towards your goals. Now, I wasn't sure what those goals were for about the first 3 hours of playing it, but eventually, once the whole flow of the game starts to make sense, it really does make sense. It's very logical. And they do a really good job of motivating you to keep playing it and to try to keep playing it better. I think I'm terrible at this game, but there's something about it that makes me want to get better at it, and it makes me feel like I probably can get better. And I'm not sure if it's learning the street layouts or learning the car physics. I think it probably has more to do with just finding cars that are, on the one hand, fast enough to win races. Some of them are too slow. Some of the cars in the game are easy to control, but you will never win a race because they're just too slow. They're not balanced with each other at all, again, because they're all based on real cars. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem.
Yeah, that is a problem.
But if you can find a car that is fast enough to actually compete and controls well enough to not crash every 5 seconds, then you can lay waste to some events, and it's really fun.
Well, I mean, that lends me to believe that there is probably one car that is the best to use in every case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's...
But you're only going to find it by trial and error.
Because it should depend on the nature of the race.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it is different for every race, but there are hundreds of different events that you could do in the game. There's no way that you're going to go through the trial and error process for every single one of them to find the optimal vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's like, if you're going for, I don't know, a downhill race, I don't know if, I mean, I think, I seem to recall one from the trailer, it's probably going to be a different car than just a straight line. So, I think having all these cars actually comes to their benefit, because you're going to want a slower car in that kind of a slalom situation.
Well, maybe this is making it too easy on me, but I would appreciate some kind of recommended car feature.
Yeah, that would be nice.
You know, given the nature of the race, how about you pick one for me? Because I've got 20 cars unlocked. They're all like crazy, like, you know, Bentleys and, you know, Lamborghinis and shit that I don't know anything about and I'll never see in real life.
Why would you take a Bentley to a race?
Exactly.
That's
it's slow.
Up.
Yeah.
It's slow. Yep. It doesn't make any sense.
It's not made to go fast. It's made for third world dictators to drive around their populace and laugh.
It's made to be made bulletproof.
It's right. It's made for dictators to go, I want that one to die.
It's
why?
Like, he looked at me funny. This car is large enough and hideous enough to be bomb proof.
That's right.
But all I can figure is that some of these cars are in the game because some higher up at EA thought that it would be a good business decision, or I don't know. I mean, a lot of these aren't even racing cars. A lot of them are not really very much fun to drive. They look crazy. You know, a lot of them look like alien cars or something, but they're not actually good for the races. So I don't get it. Like, I'm trying, like, it's actually a motivator for me to explore the city and try to find all the cars that are kind of hidden, but not really. They're just kind of sitting around. You just have to be thorough.
Free Pagani Zonda, whoever won.
Yeah. No, it really does kind of feel that way. But I want to find them all just so I have the tools in the toolkit to maybe have a chance of beating some of these races. Because a lot of these I'm doing really poorly, and I feel like it comes down to the vehicle choice more than anything. But I didn't really choose that intentionally. It's just kind of whatever I had at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know on what basis to choose these cars, because the events are so varied and there's so many of them. There's no way that I'm going to just be able to kind of look at the name of it and say, oh yeah, I need to get the Jaguar for that one.
You know, I think it's an issue of this game had a choice to make, and they could either appease Car Guy, who is a relatively loyal market,
who loves Need for Speed.
Yeah, that's kind of the problem. That they're more into like Forza.
I can put up with playing with racing in Gran Turismo with a suboptimal car, because the whole point of that game is knowing about the cars and what they're good for. You know, that's the point of that game. If you don't like that, you're probably not even playing that game. But Need for Speed, I wouldn't go Need for Speed to worry about that, right?
Like, it just feels like they made the call to appease Forza Guy and not. I mean, like I said, Forza Guy is actually more anal retentive about his cars than Gran Turismo Guy. That's the level of just asshattery that has come out of that particular subculture.
Yeah,
and wait until Drive Club or whatever they showed for PS4.
Drive Club.
I can masturbate so hard to all these cars.
Look at the fabric. That fabric's not real. That's not the way the real car is. It's triple mesh, not double mesh.
Well, that's a good way to summarize my experience so far with Must Wanted, is that I feel that there's a really, really, really fun open world driving game here, but it's kind of burdened with this car
fetishization,
you know, fetishism that I don't appreciate and I don't understand. And it's actually getting in the way of me playing it.
Yeah.
Whereas I wish they would just kind of let me, I don't know. I wish there was balance so that any car would work in any race. Maybe there are optimal choices, but every car is viable. And I feel like a lot of the events that I've been doing, I pick a car because I like the way it looks or because it seems like it would be a good choice, but I don't know. And I get in there and it's, dude, my top speed is at least 30 miles per hour too slow to even get close to the pack. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's really annoying, because then I have to, start over and pick a different car. How many times am I going to have to go through that process before I get lucky and find one that actually works?
Yeah.
It's things like that are irritating, but I can probably put up with it because playing the game is just really fun. You know, and I like the world I like the city that they've set up. It's really fun to explore. So I'm kind of iffy on it right now, but I got it for $30. So I'm pretty happy with it so far.
Is that a permanent price cut or was that a temporary thing?
It was a temporary deal. But, you know, I think for $60, the things they've added to this game for the Wii U version are not worth paying full brand new price for it. You know, they're not worth the $60 original price point for a game that's 4 months old now. Now, I think some of the features are nice. I think they've rebalanced certain things. Like every car comes with a basic nitro system, which if you think about, I mean, considering the game drives like Burnout, you kind of have to have nitro. Like the game would be unplayable without nitro. So I can't imagine having to go earn that for every single car you find in the game. It's really stupid. So I'm glad they did that. The ability to play on the gamepad works extremely well, and you can flip back and forth very fast. The co-driver mode is dumb. Like, I played it with a friend last Friday. It doesn't, the co-driver doesn't have very much to do. At best, you can open up the map and sort of be the navigator, but it's not that much fun for that person. But as a single-player game, which is primarily what I bought it for, I think it's pretty good. And the online multiplayer, I'm actually interested in trying that because these games are known for having really well-integrated online multiplayer stuff. And on the Wii U, I actually have enough people on my list to probably pull that off. So I'm going to be trying that soon. Anyway, let's move on to Guillaume.
Yeah, so my review of Tokitori 2 is out. I gave it a pretty good score. It's a really great game.
That's the next segment!
But yeah, like we talked about it last week. I've played more of it, and you know what we said about it still stands. Like, it's very different from the first game, but it's still very, very hard. There's an open world as opposed to discrete levels. You're limited to two abilities, which are their main use is to, you know, attract or repel critters in the world. And those critters are essentially your tools. Like, they are the puzzles, and they are the tools with which you solve the puzzle. Yeah. So it's really, really well made. And I've seen, you know, like I haven't really read other reviews, but I see that the scores seem to oscillate between like 7 and 9. And the people who, you know, give it lower scores just say, well, you know, this is good, but it's so hard. Like, it's so difficult. And, you know, the game really doesn't help you in any way to figure out something when you're stuck. And I kind of think that's the point of puzzle games. Like,
there's a difference, though. A puzzle game can still help you.
Sure, but
I think it's a fine line, and it's the kind of thing that people are going to break on either side of.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, so many,
no matter what.
Yeah, but I mean, like, we're so used at this point, I think, with modern games to just like come into a room, and your character has like inner monologue, like stupidly talks to himself and says like, oh, these shelves look weak. And then instantly, like, you don't have time to think for yourself. You don't have to explore. It's just like, okay, I guess I should go next to these shelves and find a way to knock them down for some reason. You know, like, you're not allowed the time to really...
Guillaume's playing Library Simulator.
That was an example from Tomb Raider. But
fuck the shelf!
So one of the more... the worst examples I can think of is Okami, where it was, you know, like, it's a Zelda clone. It's supposed to have puzzles, but I can't think of one puzzle that wasn't solved before you even attempted to solve it. You always had the little green guy, Isun, I think, just telling you basically, hey, look at that ball, and look at that hole. Looks like a ball could fit into that hole. Huh? Huh? You know, and then you're just, okay, I guess I'm going to push that ball in that hole. Thanks. As if I couldn't have figured that out myself. Of course, the Tokitori 2 puzzles are a little bit more involved than just pushing, you know, balls in holes. But just
that's all life is. That's all life is, man.
This entire show has been building up to that joke.
Anyway, like, it's just, I think that when your entire game, like, there's no real enemies in the game. There's no real, you don't have any. It's not an action game. It's a puzzle game. So if you let the game solve the puzzles for you, or if you go to a FAQ, or if you ask for help, I kind of think you're depriving yourself of the satisfaction of solving the puzzles yourself. And there is one particular puzzle that had not only me, but also my girlfriend stumped, like, for hours. And we were just getting desperate. And we even, like, doodled various solutions and just, you know, like, okay, this doesn't work because of this, and that doesn't work either. And yeah, we're getting desperate. And I even, at some point, I tweeted the developer and asked them, like, come on, I give up. How do you solve this? And they were like, well, you're probably, you know, doing the wrong thing. You know, it's simpler than you think. And I'm just like, you assholes.
but can't you always go to a different stage and just do something else?
Yeah, you can go elsewhere. And
it's
you
very
know,
open structured, right?
True. You don't have to do things in any particular order. You know, like you
and that
can
was
just,
the problem in the first game.
Yeah, and you just like basically... When they call this game like an open world game or a Metroidvania, really all it means is that you start from a central location and you expand outward, you know, like you explore more and more of the map. But there's no real, like, there's no backtracking. There's no actual, you know, like Metroid elements here. You always keep the same two abilities and it's just a matter of, you know, okay, which puzzle am I gonna try next? You know, and which road am I going to take next? So yeah, like you can do that, but eventually you're going to come to a point where you're going to have to go back to that one puzzle that has stumped you for so long, and you're going to have to solve it. So that's what I did, and eventually I realized, oh shit, I think I didn't notice this about the puzzle. And then sure enough, like it didn't take very long after I noticed the right thing, but I solved it, and I was like, wow, I should have seen this like hours ago, you know, but I was just like so trying to always do things in a certain way, like in a certain order, that I couldn't conceive of.
You only looked at it a certain way.
Yeah, and I think there comes a point when you're frustrated, when you're just doing the same thing over and over again, and of course it's not going to work, you know, the 10th time that you try the same solution. So my advice to people playing the game is that if...
Don't.
No, do. It's an awesome game. But if, you know, if you find yourself like thinking, okay, I almost pulled that off. I think that next time I can really solve it, you know, and you're doing that like 3-4 times, you don't have the solution. Look elsewhere, you know, like try something else because the puzzles are usually not that hard to execute. And it's just, you probably missed something like some crucial aspect of the environment or the way that these critters interact with each other that, you know, that, yeah, that you fail to notice. And that is what you need to take into account to finally solve the puzzle. It's unfortunate. I don't want to give any specific examples because then I'm kind of spoiling, you know, the whole point of the game. But I, you know, like I just encourage you to think more about the puzzles before going for like the Miiverse and ask for help. You know, everything can be solved by a human being. You know, the game will make you
well,
think.
Well, that's reassuring.
I know.
My robot consultant will be very disappointed.
The game will make you think that you're an idiot, but that's fine. You probably are, just like I am. But there are some things I didn't say in the review because I don't think they're that important. Like, I didn't really put emphasis on the fact that it's an open world because really it's not. Like, there's no real... The puzzles are essentially like one or two screen wide at most. They're self-contained. They're just, you know, you're not going to have to solve something at one end of the map to have access to another end of the map. It doesn't work mm-hmm. that way. You're just mm-hmm. coming across discrete puzzles on the specific road that you're traveling, you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, the game looks fantastic. The enemies, like some, I shouldn't say enemies, but yeah, the creatures in the world have like all their own habits. Like if two frog looking things are just traveling along a path, every time that they meet face to face, they'll just start croaking at each other. They'll just stop and just be like, rawr, 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 rawr. Like, they're talking. It's fucking adorable.
Yeah.
It's awesome. And, yes, so much details. And some of those details do come into play in the puzzles.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm going to spoil that. Like, if you think, you know, a certain animation is insignificant or, you know, you notice some really weird detail that, you know, like, oh, wow, how come the developer went through the trouble of doing this? There's a chance that it might be the solution that you're looking for, or that it mm-hmm. will come into play later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So you almost said enemies. Are there enemies in the game? Can you die? Are there hit points? Are there health?
Yeah, there's a there are certain things that can instantly kill you. Like there's like walls of lava, or, you know, if you go underwater and can't get out in time, you're going to drown.
Okay.
There's enemies that react violently if you stomp the ground next to them. So be on the lookout for that. Sometimes, like, there's a certain type of creature that will just ram into whatever it's, like, whatever direction it's looking at. And it will kill other creatures it comes into contact with. So some of the puzzles will involve, you know, trying to not kill the other critters that are integral to the solution of certain puzzles. And yeah, like the tweeting ability that we said kind of worked like Ocarina of Time.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really solve puzzles. It's mostly to like go back to the main map, or to basically like warp back to the last checkpoint. So like these kind of tunes that you can sing that you learn along the way are, you know, not new abilities. They're just things that help you, you know, start over when you've done something
shortcuts.
Wrong. Yeah. Yeah.
So that kind of gets to my next question, which was that if you started the game over and played it over from the beginning, knowing what you know now, would you really have alternate solutions through the game because of, you know, your increased knowledge of the abilities that you have? Or is that stuff just mainly for convenience?
Well, what would actually happen is that if you were that, the thing that would happen is that you would notice a puzzle that perhaps you hadn't solved the first time around, and then you'd solve it and you'd reveal a new path. Like you'd find a secret. But most of the secrets are actually kind of part of the main game. So I don't know if, like, if you started over from the beginning, like, what would probably happen is that you would finish a game in half an hour instead of 20 hours, you know? And you might also find some, you know, cute secrets. Like, I found some really interesting things that I wish I could spoil, but I don't want to. But these developers have, like, you know, a crazy imagination. There's just, like, some really weird shit in Tokitori 2.
Awesome.
So look forward to that.
I'm excited. I'm going to download it as soon as we finish tonight.
Woo.
And it's 10% off for the like, first 2 weeks.
Yeah, like $13 or so.
Because that's really cool. You can do sales on Wii U.
Yeah, of course you can. I think that's really smart because it encourages people who might be kind of on the fence to go ahead and buy it now, which kind of helps the developer a lot. But then it also gets more people playing up front, and then they talk about it, and then other people want to play it even after the price goes up. And the price difference is not so much that you're going to turn people off who say, I'm not paying $15 for that. It was only $5 the first week it came out. You know, I mean, it's only $1.50 that you're saving, but it's enough to maybe push some people over who were kind of not totally sure. It's very, very smart. So we're going to wrap up new business with James.
Yeah. So before we went to PAX, I had gone slightly overboard with some purchasing. You know, I go and I check on Amazon and I find about, you know, 5-6 GameCube games that I missed out on when I was, you know, when the GameCube was still actually alive. Kind of wanted to see how much of an expense would this purchase end up being. And I had a number. I was like, well, that's kind of expensive, but okay, whatever. And for $65, I think I ended up with just an absolute ton of games. Well, I ended up buying them because whatever.
So these were all games that you'd never played in the first place,
or maybe played very briefly. And,
okay.
Yeah, I never owned them. Is the best.
Yeah, like things that you kind of missed out on.
Yeah. So I picked them almost entirely based on memory of the conversation about those games when they came out. I did not do research.
So what is the list?
So the list is PNO3, Auto Modelista, Wario World, Battalion Wars, Odama, because fuck everything, Donkey Kong Jungle Beat with bongos.
Oh, nice. Lovely.
And then for Mr. John Lindemann, I purchased BMX Triple X.
Awesome.
which will be sent to you at some point in the future so that you...
Sweet.
And Mrs. Lindemann may enjoy it together.
Oh, whoa, 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 that's
BMX, Triple X.
It's going to interrupt our Bible study, James. Come on.
just
can't have that. We can't have that, you know?
There had been a long-running joke between John, Greg, and myself that John and I would one day just exchange really hellacious games and only Greg would know what they were. before the episode where we opened them live on the show and went, oh, fuck you. and then we were more or less in the place of having to play them with Greg kind of introducing them.
Well, the good thing is about that, James, is that there will always be shitty games for us to exchange.
Oh, there will be. And we just never got around to doing it, unfortunately. Yeah. But that one came up and it was like 72 cents. And I'm with box and manual and everything. I'm like, well, oh, yeah. Wow. That's going to happen.
It was the collector's edition of BMX Triple X.
I was like, well, this needs to go down.
Yeah.
So that was added to the long list. So my thought is I don't really need to just gun them. I don't need to just burn through them all the way and go, I have completed this game. Because they're really more to give me additional frames of reference for forums like this on the show, where every game you can play, if you're on a show like this, is sort of prep for future conversations where that game may become relevant as a conversation.
Yeah, even if you're not talking about that specific game, but sometimes it gives you a frame of reference.
Right. Yep. It gives you a place to have conversations from. And we pull from our library of experience when we write, when we talk about it on the show, you know, when we have conversations with each other that aren't for, you know, an audience. They give us a frame of reference for games that came later. So it's interesting that the games I picked, because the Nintendo ones all had Wii sequels. Jungle Beat had a Wii sequel.
No, it didn't.
Well, it had another Donkey Kong platformer, and it had a game created by the team that made it that was a hugely successful Wii game.
Yeah, but when you play Jungle Beat, you will realize just how different it is from DKCR.
Fine, yeah. But
it looks similar.
Well, and they could say the same thing about the Wario game, but there was a sort of another imaging of what Wario is as a game that came out on the Wii, which we revered heavily on the show. And then obviously Battalion Wars, which had its sequel, was widely reviewed by our site.
I don't know if we made that joke.
Yeah, we haven't made that reference in about a year and a half. But
it's not so inside if you actually try to find the review.
It is inside, though, if you try to find the review copy.
Hmm.
But so I've started the process of working through them.
I'm looking forward to, like, your Odama addiction episode.
That's great. You know, I absolutely think Yu Saito is the best game developer in the world because he's the craziest. And that counts for something. So
it didn't count for your purchase of Aeroporter. Did it?
No, it didn't, because that wasn't crazy enough. If it was Aeroporter where you controlled it exclusively with a 3DS microphone, I'm in. Let's go. Let's do this. But it didn't. So we're gonna have to talk later, Mr. Saito. But it's, you know, I'm interested to get through these games. You know, it's a personal opportunity to expand the horizons of the games I've played, and you know, I got good deals on all of them. I mean,
yeah. Good on you, man. So you're still in the survey phase right now?
I'm still in the survey phase. So okay. I've got two that I can talk about. I don't think I'm going to go back to either of them. P&O 3, which I played. I basically went through the Capcom 2 right now. I hit P&O 3, and I worked that game pretty much through the majority of it. I haven't quite cleared it. I thought I had. I'm like, no, I didn't. Never mind. I'm an idiot.
The thing about P&O 3 is if you've played 3 hours of it, you've played the whole game. Because it just kind of repeats after that.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. And I've played Auto Modelista, which is, I'll talk about first, because I have less to say about it. It's, first off, it still looks really good. So if you don't know much about that game, you'd be totally forgiven. The only reason I remember that game at all is because of the screenshots that came out from it back in 2002. It is a very, very Japanese racing game. It goes the licensed car route. It goes the car tuning route. You know, there's all the different kinds of races that you can do. There's like the downhill jam. There's the in traffic. There's like the sharp turns courses.
When you said car tuning, I thought you meant cartooning.
No, well, see, that's
which
kind
actually
of funny
applies to this game.
Because the reason this game is memorable is exclusively because of the visuals, which is a remarkably well rendered and, you know, acceptable even now, cel shaded style that on the cars looks really visually arresting. On the backgrounds, it's kind of eh, but even looking at it now, it looks like something you could download off the Xbox Marketplace, and you'd be like, yeah, this is okay. I mean, you compare it to stuff that came out later that's realistic, and you're like, it looks better than that. I'm happy with this. So it's my thoughts on the game are, it's really hard. It's just unfair. So the cars all feel like, not only are they smooth, but their tires are so smooth you have no grip at all. So you're constantly sliding in and out of turns. So it's like living in Too Fast, Too Furious at this point. I mean, you're just skidding around corners and slamming into things. It's stupid enjoyable, but I don't know that I really want to play it that much. The amount of customization you can do to your cars is impressive. The amount of little things you can tweak. The number of cars in the game is kind of cool, but it's just, you know, it's just not my bag. I'm glad I played it though, because it went from being memories in my brain from when I was in basically high school, like a freshman in high school, seeing pictures of this game on the internet and in magazines, and having it on my TV in my apartment, you know, 4 years out of college, and going, you know, this still looks really cool. Good for them.
Yeah.
The other game I played, which I imagine I'll have a little bit more buy-in from the rest of the crowd here, is PNO3.
Yeah.
Which is, first off, that game is weird. I mean, you know it's weird going in. You're playing as a woman who, I guess she was paralyzed, and they put her in this bodysuit that made her dance around like an idiot and shoot things out of her hand.
It's like the Japanese retelling of Mantis, the superhero TV show from the early 90s.
Nice, yes. Except I don't think he wore sunglasses and jiggled his butt around a lot.
No, he wore a really ugly costume.
Nice. But so, for those of you who are maybe too young to even remember this game, you run around you start the game in this big open area, which is completely broken for the game's gameplay style, because it just doesn't work in that space. It's much more of a hallway shooter where you sort of stand there and shoot things with these pulse shots, and then basically dance out of the way of enemy return fire. I mean, you literally dance in and out of scene by just these really athletic dodge maneuvers that you execute by, I think it's by the shoulder buttons, if I recall correctly. It's interesting. It's a lot of corridors, a lot of running up and down hallways and shooting enemies that pop out from behind corners, and a lot of just looking at Vanessa Z. Schneider stand there and bounce up and down. It's kind of a weird experience to play, I'll be honest.
Yeah. So you said you didn't do much research on these games before you bought them. If you had, you might have come across my review from 2003, which I gave it a 6 out of 10, and made a lot of the same comments that you're making now. So
yeah.
I agree, mean, in retrospect.
Yeah, I mean, this game, even if I had seen the 6, I probably would have still bought this game, if only because it's an interesting piece of conversation.
Did you notice, I'm not just making a crude joke about her ass, but did you notice that the environments and characters, just in general, have a roundness to them?
Like
a smooth curvature to the walls and the different objects that
her,
is
yes,
very
John.
Unusual for that era?
It is, and I noticed that too. Everything looks, when stuff gets zoomed in, there is, you know, there's serious cases of the Jaggies going on, mm-hmm. but the architecture of things and of people and of creatures is very round, and it is very unusual. Lots of things are very boxy on games of that era, especially because this was also a PS2 game, wasn't it? No, it wasn't.
This was actually GameCube exclusive.
You're right, it was. Yeah, it was one of the only ones that stayed that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is a certain jagginess around detail parts, but stuff that's not detailed, stuff that's just sort of these flat, shiny colors, because a lot of the walls are metal, and they look really nice. I mean, they have a nice, you know, roundness, organicness to them that you just don't see in games from that era. I'm really pleased with it, to be honest. And visual, like I said, it looks kind of muddy. The colors don't quite work right. Like, it should have been brighter or something. I'm not positive. Mm-hmm. But it's still a nice game. It's a nice looking game that, you know, doesn't play that well.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, I paid $3 for it. I can't complain.
Yeah, it's a cool experiment, and a very overlooked game that has some qualities that are worth remembering, even if the game is very flawed.
Sup, Vanquish?
I think Vanquish is a lot better.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I know, but I mean, I played the demo of Vanquish after playing this. I'm like, mm-hmm.
It's definitely a spiritual successor.
Yeah.
I'm like, sup.
It's, yeah.
Yeah, I remember this.
It seems like from what I've played of Vanquish, it seems to be from what I remember of seeing of Piano 3. I've never actually played it. Seems very similar, in the same vein at least.
Yeah.
Except there's not an attractive woman bouncing up and down all the time.
True.
Vanquish is more of a full-on character action game, and the way you move the character around the environments is very important.
Yeah.
PNO3 is more of a kind of stop-and-pop shooter.
Yep.
So when you do kind of get in cover in PNO3, but while you're in that cover, you're going to pop up and shoot all the guys like they're a shooting gallery, and you're probably not going to be spinning around to different pieces of cover. You're definitely not going to be running through the environment hoping to dodge things, because that's a very fast way to die.
Mm-hmm.
There's no melee attacks, as I recall. So it
there
really does feel like it's kind of like a gallery shooter or a shoot 'em up.
And it really is, because usually you're really far down the hall from them as well.
Yeah, and then you shoot all those enemies, and then you kind of move up a little ways to the next barrel or barrier that you can kind of hide behind, and then you do it again. And so there's not enough interesting interstitial action between the shooting bits to make it feel like a fully complete experience. And that's something I think Vanquish totally solves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, we're going to have to wrap up new business. It sounds like we got a lot of very interesting GameCube games to come up in the next few weeks. And we're playing a lot of other stuff too, but you know, we can only spend so much time on this segment because we got to get to retroactive and other topics coming up after the break.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
So this week we have a preview, Shin Megami Tensei Devil Summoner Soul Hackers for 3DS by Kimberly Keller. Long title as always, Atlus has remade the Sega Saturn and Sony PlayStation game Western audiences were denied due to quote-unquote content. See that bannable material in 3D soon.
Next up we have a review for the long-awaited Game and Wario on Wii U. It's a Japan import review by Don Koopman. This is not your father's Wario's minigame collection. Shoot your nose bow and bowl your ball at Wario. Play the long-awaited shield pose. Too bad some of the minigames are weirdly a bit too short.
We have a review this week of Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate 3DS version by Josh Max. Capcom didn't make the unavoidable 3D punch, but they did strong-arm Nintendo into releasing a totally insane 3DS cradle / 3D circle pad. And it turns out, it's totally worth it. Lastly, we have a review of Tokitori 2 on Wii U by Guillaume. Tweet and pound your way through some puzzles. We just talked about it, but in case you forgot, Guillaume really likes Tokitori 2, and if you did forget, you can go read about it.
Please do.
So you can find all of this, plus we did finally get up our pictures from PAX East. There's some great stuff on there, lots of other content, right there at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. We're going to get to retroactive in just a few minutes, but since John has not been able to play the game due to his move, he's probably going to step out for that part, and I wanted to keep him engaged at least a little bit here in the second segment. And there's been some weird stuff going on lately in the world of Nintendo and video games, so I thought we could briefly talk about a couple of kind of newsy topics before we get to the retroactive, because East Book 2 probably won't take as long as Book 1 did. It's very similar, and we don't have quite as many comments about it. So the first thing, this is a very recent news, but we found out that Disney, who now own all of the George Lucas stuff, including Star Wars, and including LucasArts, have decided to shut down LucasArts.
Wait, what? LucasArts was still going on?
Yeah.
You know, you make that joke, but they actually were a relatively productive company.
I guess so.
They were
so.
Putting out about 2 to 3 games a year.
Mm,
Okay.
They were.
Well, the last game that they put out was Kinect Star Wars, which was not quite a year ago, but quite a while ago, it feels like. And was an abomination, of course.
Right.
And
or
they,
genius, depending on if you're thinking they're trolling or not.
Yeah, I feel like they hadn't really put out very many good things in a long time, but they have a storied history in the world of video games, especially in computer games.
True. Right.
Many Star Wars games we could talk about. A lot of the best Star Wars games, I would argue, they didn't actually develop. You know, they were made by Factor 5 or they were made by BioWare.
Yeah.
Made by various different groups, but LucasArts at least published them. So they had some hand, you know, in the quality control and in the development of those games.
Well,
still.
And to a certain extent in deciding who should get them and what they should do with them.
Yep.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But before that, in the first, I don't know, 10 or 15 years of LucasArts' existence, they actually weren't allowed to make Star Wars games. The idea was that they would use some of the technology that had been developed by George Lucas's film company, Lucasfilm, and also Industrial Light and Magic, and they spun off this video game group and sort of tasked them with making new original properties with some of the resources that Lucas had developed in making his films. And they became really famous early on for a lot of point and click PC games, which
yep.
we've talked
mm-hmm.
about on and off and on over the years here on RFN, even though there weren't very many of them on Nintendo systems. I mean, there was Maniac Mansion, which
yep.
was a great early LucasArts game, and that was on NES, and that was one of my very early exposures to point and click adventures. So anyway, that's probably the part that a lot of the hardcore fans are really lamenting, but really that was a long time ago. They haven't made games like that in a long time. And in the past 10 years, 15 years, it seemed like they had become pretty much a Star Wars game publisher. And a lot of those games, I felt the quality started to go down a lot in the past decade or so. But I kind of wanted to get your reactions to this news and, you know, How you kind of feel about it? How do we move on without in a world without LucasArts?
So I mean, we sort of gave kind of a low discussion there. I mean, they also developed a lot of the technology that became part and parcel with other games in them. They developed the first dynamic system for mapping music to action on screen. They had a lot of these things that they developed as a technology.
I'm use.
Yeah, I mean. The Lucas Enterprise really is at its heart a technology company that happens to make media, and
mm-hmm.
and they were really no different. I mean, for me, I don't know how many LucasArts games I've played over my life. You know, they had all their scum games, which sounds terrible, but it's their engine they use to do these point and clicks. But even before that, they had games that they put out. You know, Johnny mentioned Maniac Mansion. It's the work of people like Ron Gilbert.
Yep.
They
yeah,
had
Tim Schafer as well.
Yeah, they had
yep.
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which they were allowed to make games based on the Indiana Jones franchise.
Day of the Tentacle as well.
Day of the Tentacle, Monkey Island.
Zach McCracken.
Yep.
Loom, which I referenced last episode unintentionally.
I mean,
unintentionally dooming the entire company.
Yep, you did it. You were responsible. I mean, they did so many really just these amazing games that had nothing to do with the Star Wars franchise. And I know, you know, we're saying, well, their Star Wars games have slid. But I mean, my favorite adventure game until I was, I don't know, you know, much older was probably, you know, the Sam and Max Freelance Police. Because even as a kid, that game is really funny. Like, you play that game, and you're like, well, this is actually really cool. I mean, they were the sort of the jump off point for a lot of people in the industry. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you had like a Gilbert. He founded like two or three other companies, and after he left, you know, he made tons of games. Schafer obviously has gone on to found Double Fine.
Well, Alex Noisy of Gaijin Games, I think. I don't think he helmed it, but he worked on Gladius. On the GameCube.
Oh, that's a good game.
Yeah.
They weren't just, you know, a place that made lots of games that we care about. They were sort of a jump-off point for a lot of developers who now, you know, all kind of march to the beat of their own drum. There's not a lot of traditional, you know, Blazinski types that came out of LucasArts. It was these guys who made very insular games that they wanted to make.
Yeah.
Yeah. Real creative types. You know?
Yeah. They come from an era, like especially in the 80s, you saw this a lot, where there wasn't really a blueprint on how you could make millions off of a game. So people just kind of made whatever they wanted to make. And whatever was a hit happened to be a hit. And they kind of come from that era. So it's kind of sad to see them go, because they were kind of, you know, even though they weren't, they really weren't that company anymore. But still, it's kind of sad to see them go, especially the way they went, being bought by a company who has done this to other, you know, game companies, bought them and then just shut them down, really. Like, why didn't you just let them be bought by somebody else if you were just going to shut them down? Like, yeah, I hate to see that.
I mean, that's unfortunate, but I think that the company was kind of gutted way before that. At some point, they brought in new management, and basically all the people who made the games, those old school games that we just talked about, all those people were gone. They were, mm-hmm. you know, let go. And there was definitely a shift then when, I don't know, I mourned LucasArts. And, you know, like, they never were the same again.
Yeah, it wouldn't make any sense for Disney to try to sell off that studio, because the people who work there have made nothing but Star Wars games for the past 10 years.
Right.
Yeah.
But,
so
I mean,
they're not going to make Star Wars games at some other company, because Disney's not going to let them. So, you know, it makes more sense to just dissolve the whole thing. Those people will go out and hopefully will get jobs other places and get to do that anyway, but not as a unit. As a studio, also, I would say as a studio, they were kind of functionally broken. I mean, they haven't made a good game in, you know, at least 6 or 8 years, I would argue. So I don't know that there was such a great machine going on at LucasArts that it's something that you could actually convince. I mean, you know, Disney probably did some research to try to see if anyone would be interested, and they probably found nobody was.
Well, I mean, to an extent, but Disney also shut down their in-house game development stuff themselves, too. I just think they don't want to be in the business.
That's absolutely.
I think
that's the pattern.
I think even if LucasArts was making, you know, good game after good game after good game, they'd probably still be inclined to shut it down. I think they're more than happy to just sell, just lease the license. And once the license is out there, they're not responsible for any amount of financial success or failure that happens. They can put riders in the contract that says, if this is a success, you have to pay us more.
Yeah, like, they just get the money. It's perfect for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Disney wants to be. Disney doesn't want to be.
And ultimately, it might be better for us as gamers and as Star Wars fans, because it gets the control of the Star Wars franchise out of the people at LucasArts the people who were left, you know, and I'm sure they were working under all kinds of stipulations and crazy rules from the parent company, but I'm not sure I'm not really sure they had the ability to make good Star Wars games anymore. And I feel like now we have the opportunity, not saying this is gonna happen, but Nintendo could make a Star Wars game. Mm-hmm. Like Nintendo could make a Star Wars game.
Yep.
And if I'm Disney, I'm thinking that's a great idea. Let's see if they're interested. You know, there's a lot of different directions they can go with it now. And before, they were really kind of tied to whatever is the capability of their own internal people, which was diminishing rapidly, I think. So,
I mean, Kinect Star Wars sort of poisons the well here, but they didn't make that game. I mean, that was made by Terminal Reality. The game they were working on was, you know, what we had seen so far was 1313.
Yeah.
Which looks unbelievable. I mean,
well, I'm sure it looks unbelievable, but before that, there was like The Force Unleashed 2 and The Force Unleashed, and before that, what, like the Obi-Wan Xbox game?
Did they develop The Force Unleashed? They did, actually. But you know what? The Force
Unleashed.
Yeah,
they developed those internally. I don't think they made because the Battlefront games were made by Paradigm, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
At least the first one was. And they ended up being, that company ended up being bought by Activision and shut down. No, they were bought by EA the same day as BioWare was.
Yeah, and that weird.
And then they were shut down.
But I mean, like, they had the games that Pandemic made for them in like 2000.
Oh, that's what I was thinking of. Sorry, Pandemic.
Yeah, I mean,
that was Battlefront. Yeah,
they had Republic Commando, which is really good. I mean, I really enjoyed that game. But you know, they also were involved in like the
Was that 2005?
I think so.
That might be the last really good game that they.
Well, so they
published.
Were involved in the Mercenary series too. They published.
Yeah.
The second one was good. It was.
I always heard the first one was good and the second one sucked. But it was a company that was, their output was not really landing with customers all that much.
No.
And especially not with critics. And to me, you know, I mean, 1313 might have turned out to be a great game, but I didn't have a whole lot of confidence in that based on the stuff they've done recently.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly weren't top tier.
No,
you know,
but
they were kind of in the middle, B-level sort of developer.
I kind of feel like, Guillaume, that I think they used to be a great company, and they've been in decline for a long time. And LucasArts is almost to the point where I hear this news and I think, wow, I thought they were already shut down. Because they haven't really released anything I've been interested in so long that it just kind of doesn't affect me. But at the same time, it is a chance to go back and reflect on the great things that they did. I mean, you know, they were involved with the Super Star Wars games back on Super Nintendo that are crazy difficult, but really cool games, really great action games.
We almost play Zombies at My Neighbors Retroactive.
And maybe we still will one day.
And that's a really funny, really weird game.
Yeah, they did a few things on NES and Super Nintendo. You know, they were involved with Rogue Squadron and Rogue Leader, which are fantastic games on N64 and GameCube. I mean, they published TIE Fighter on PC, which is one of my all-time favorite PC games.
Shadows of the Empire? Did they do that? Did they do Shadows of the Empire?
They were involved. Yeah, absolutely. They were involved in Shadows of the Empire, which is a very flawed game, but really fun still.
And somehow they managed to make something that's still kind of my favorite first-person shooter ever. Dark Forces 2 Jedi Knight. And mostly because for most of the game, you don't have to play in first person and you don't have to shoot. But still, that was a great game.
Oh, yeah, that people, game is beloved. It's a classic game. Yeah. Classic.
You know, and we haven't mentioned it yet, but Grim Fandango is a game I've never played, but some of my friends absolutely adore it.
Oh, it's amazing. It is such an
amazing
have
tried
game.
To get me to play that game for a long time, and I just never got around to it.
I absolutely enjoy that game. But I mean, you know,
it's only been like my icon on message boards for the past
10
years.
It is your Twitter icon.
I mean, but I think the reason this game or this had such resonance is not only did, you know, a lot of people have really strong memories of these games, but they were sort of the jumping off point for not just, you know, the people who we know for adventure games, but you know, the people who made the TIE Fighter games used to be at LucasArts. A lot of the people at the companies they contracted to make these games in that middle time frame were LucasArts people. I mean, this is a company that ultimately has a very big family tree that comes out of it.
Yeah.
And and what happens is in the echo chamber that is our industry, that those people, you know, have each individually their own cult followings that when they see this news, they kind of lament for what, you know, where they were at that point in their life when they were young and they were just so enamored by the industry and where they were in it that they're just, you know, all that it sort of they grieve publicly and it sort of, you know,
I don't know. I follow Ron Gilbert on Twitter, and he didn't seem too distressed over it.
He wasn't distressed over that, but he was, you know, he expressed some general pining for a previous time period of that franchise, which, I mean, I think
I think he also talked about trying to get the rights to Monkey Island
back from them. So when Disney bought them out, and he basically said, "Hey Disney, you have the license to a game I made. I'll buy it from you. I don't have any money though." I mean, it'll be interesting to see if Disney's willing to part with any of those licenses, because I mean, they're not going to use Monkey Island.
No,
right? They're never going to do anything with that property ever again.
No.
Yeah. So hopefully they will kind of auction them off, or
maybe this was all just a roundabout way to never get sued over the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
There you go.
Because I guess we won't get into the story, but, you know, apparently there was a movie script for a Secret of Monkey Island movie, and it features everything that you see in those Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Really? So it would have sucked horribly.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad it didn't get made.
I actually liked some of the games that came out, you know, when they did their pivot towards a more Star Wars focused company. It was kind of upsetting. I did like to see that late in the 2000s they were starting to pivot away. You know, they did do Mercenaries, they did do Thrillville,
Even in the middle, and they tried stuff like RTX Red Rock, which I thought on paper sounded awesome. It's like a game where you play a Martian astronaut, you know, and you're investigating. It's the story's kind of similar to Moon on DS, but the execution just, you know, didn't work. But it was a great idea. They did Gladius, you know, back in 2004, I think it was, for GameCube and PS2. That's a turn-based strategy RPG. That is like a Fire Emblem game, rated M, bloody as hell.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
What a weird thing for LucasArts to put out.
I was really happy to see, you know, they worked with Telltale to let us get some of these games that Telltale's made using their old franchises.
Mm, yeah.
Like, I really felt like this company maybe had, you know, they had to shake off some of the rust that they had accumulated over the years. And they started talking about that in the late 2000s. You know, they said, you know, we've made a lot of shitty Star Wars games. We just have. And I mean, they were open.
And then they made Kinect Star Wars.
Well, that came later. And I think that probably came from the corporate master saying, we want to have a Kinect game.
Well, that's kind of the problem, though.
Yeah. It's a natural fit.
Anyway, we got to move on from that, but I wanted to give it, you know, just a little bit of time. So another thing, we have to constrain this. We're going to try very hard because we do want to get to retroactive, but this blog came out this week that I found very interesting. I know John did too. That's why I wanted to talk about it before he leaves. Emily Rogers from Not Enough Shaders, that's NES, which is an online blog, wrote a very long, very exhaustive analysis of quotes from Satoru Iwata, the president of Nintendo, and basically showing that there are patterns to his statements over the last decade. He's been president of Nintendo for about 10 years. I think it'll be 10 years in May or in June, as of E3. But basically showing that he keeps making promises that, you know, we recognize the mistakes from last time or we're going to fix them, and then they don't fix them. And then the next time he has a chance, he says, we're not going to make that mistake again. And then he still makes it even like a third time. And there's a few other points, but that's kind of the gist of it. That's the general pattern that she shed some light on. And then there's a lot of editorializing as well, where she basically makes the claim that although Iwata is an extremely likable personality in the world of video games, and it's very hard to dislike him, he's maybe not a good CEO. He's maybe not actually learning the lessons that he keeps saying he's going to correct. So I wanted to especially give John a chance to respond to this. I'm personally a little ambivalent on it, but I certainly think it's well worth reading, and we'll put a link in the show notes for this episode because I think it's something a lot of our listeners would be very interested in reading. It's been getting some very strong comments all on the internet, both for and against the points that she makes, and you know, it's something to chew on. You know, it's not news, it's just someone's analysis, but it's a pretty damning analysis, and it's a topic that we've addressed many times over the years. You know, how is Iwata doing? Is it going to be different this time? Are they getting better? Are they fixing things? So John, what was your take on this?
Well, I think it really it underscores kind of what has sort of kind of puzzled us, especially probably over the last couple of years, has been the kind of mistakes that Nintendo repeatedly makes for reasons that are really kind of hard to understand. I mean, when the 3DS launched, the 3DS was overpriced and there was a drought of games. Iwata comes out and says, we can't have that happen again. Well, the Wii U comes out and it's overpriced and there's a drought of games. Now, you can't lay that entirely at Iwata's feet because, you know, other consoles going back to the N64 have had droughts of games and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's very interesting kind of, you know, I mean, ultimately you can blame Iwata for everything because he runs the company. But it's interesting from the standpoint of kind of how Nintendo really does or really seems to be looking at things with the Japanese market in mind. Really going all the way back. I mean, they don't cater to Western third parties really at all. And I think things are actually getting worse with, you know, with EA. They have like kind of weird, conflicts with
they're
Amazon.
Definitely not getting better.
They're not getting better. And there's, you also have weird things going on, like this kind of conflict with Amazon where Amazon won't sell their products. So I just really wonder, I kind of wonder what's going on. And, And, you know, Iwata, when you look at, I mean, he's been CEO since when? About 2004, I think. Is that right? Early 2000s. In there. And when you look in there, so he came in about the end of the GameCube days. And
certainly in the latter half.
The latter half of the GameCube era. And you kind of have to wonder, really, this article was interesting for me because it kind of made me step back and say, okay, let's just look at the facts and let's look at over the course of his entire reign as CEO, what the company has done. And things were not going well coming out of GameCube. Everybody, you always hear the same thing. Oh, Nintendo's, they're going to go third party. They need to get out of the hardware game, all that kind of stuff. They come out with Wii. It blows the doors off everything. They come out with DS, blows the doors off of everything, right? That's great. But of course, you know, now that really doesn't count anymore. Nobody really cares about that anymore, that success.
Yeah, it was all 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, 5-6 years ago, it doesn't really matter anymore. But the thing is, the shareholders are the ones that you really have to worry about because they're the ones that see Nintendo kind of – the 3DS is doing well, but the Wii U is really, really tanking. I mean – badly.
You know, John, I just want to play on something you just said because it's very, very important. You've said two different things. One is that Nintendo really caters to the Japanese market and they don't seem to care what happens in the West.
Yep.
And number two, they really have a problem with the shareholders. Well, guess
shareholders
what?
Are Japanese.
That's
all exactly
of their
it.
Shareholders are Japanese. It's very, yep. very difficult to buy shares in Nintendo if you're a foreigner.
In fact, they actively attempt to prevent you from doing it.
Yep.
So he's trying to appease his Japanese shareholders, and no matter what he does, number one, it kind of works in Japan. I mean, 3DS and Wii U's not doing that great, but in the end, there's not really a whole lot to challenge it in Japan, I would say. I think in the end, Wii U will be relatively successful compared to its competitors over there. 3DS is doing great over there, but not as well as their investors would like because it's not a phone.
Well, you know. I mean, I don't know about the Wii U because, I mean, it's getting outsold by Vita. So
not week to week.
It's but it's not doing well
just
over there.
Just once or twice. That's not sustainable, probably.
The Wii U is not doing well. But even, I mean, regardless of the console sales itself, the software sales for Vita in Japan right now are terrible.
Yeah.
I mean for Wii U.
There's not much coming out. A Game & Wario did just come out. We'll see how it does, but it doesn't really seem like a blockbuster.
No,
kind
I mean,
of
but see, that's the whole thing, though. So regardless, the Wii U is not selling well in the West, but Iwata doesn't seem to be addressing that.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, it's a dealing with that particular problem. There's not a ton you can do on short notice. I mean, besides cut the price aggressively, which is probably coming, but my guess is it comes closer to E3 than now.
Or maybe closer to Christmas. So, James, I think the argument that the blog makes is that this problem, not only did we all see it coming, but Iwata himself saw the problem
but,
coming.
I mean, he can't... Mm-hmm.
And he had a chance to preempt it, and it's not clear really what he did. And maybe he tried really hard to prevent it from happening, and the things he tried just didn't work. And it's from our perspective, it's hard to see that stuff because of the lack of transparency.
Well, I mean, the problem is, though, how do you force... I mean, short of... you know, making it free. How do you ensure that there's quality third-party titles on your system? It's really difficult.
And that's what the article touches on, is the fact that Nintendo routinely almost goes out of their way to make hardware that makes Western third parties shy away from them. Now, however you feel about Western third parties, doesn't matter. If you want Nintendo, the phrase that actually
they make
uses,
the games that sell the most.
That's that they make the games that sell in North America. So if you want your console to sell in North America, you have to cater to those guys to a certain degree. And Iwata just really doesn't feel like doing that, and also doesn't really seem to understand that. He doesn't really seem to get that. He's like, okay, well we'll give you an HD console. Okay, yeah, but that HD console is using an engine that they would have already made for PS3 and 360, so they don't want to go back and put their new stuff and retrofit it to the older tech that you're giving them. You know, that's, and I know Nintendo is, you know, Nintendo really isn't too much there. They don't gear themselves towards being a tech company without having, you know, the hottest, but it's like not having Western support is becoming a real problem for Nintendo. Hmm. Not in the portable arena, because in the portable arena, region doesn't really matter that much. It's not like consoles. I mean, with consoles, it's a really big deal, the kind of games you can play, right? You know, because, I mean, in the West, people like their games to be, you know, more realistic. Online is a huge deal. In Japan, not really, not so much. Online isn't that big of a deal. And so a lot of the games that Nintendo makes are geared towards this kind of Japan-centric style of gaming, which really isn't as big in the West. So it's, I don't know. Nintendo is, I feel like they're kind of backing themselves into a corner. And I mean, you have to lay that at Iwata's feet. I mean, you see them over the years making the same mistakes over and over again. And I don't know if, it makes me wonder if Iwata is just a puppet or what.
But for who?
Like, is he really in charge? I don't know.
Yamauchi?
I don't know.
I don't think so. That's very conspiratorial,
well,
in my opinion.
Well, and if he's not, then it's his fault.
You're right. I mean, you have to give him credit for the things Nintendo has done well. And,
absolutely.
You know, and you have to look at the Wii as a massive success for them at a moment in time. And I think if you look at the Wii from a more zoomed out view over a longer period of time, it's maybe wasn't so good for them because they made a ton of money on it way up front for 2 or 3 years, which is a long time to be the leading console, and they did extremely well for themselves. But then the stuff that happened in the back half of the Wii's lifespan, not only was it bad for Nintendo at the time, mm-hmm. it also created the environment into which they launched Wii U.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to say, well, we tried to change some things about Wii U to make it more appealing to, you know, hardcore gamers, Western developers, et cetera, but you're trying to convince people who've been kind of burned on the Wii, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you have to convince them that you're doing something drastically different. When you name the console Wii U and you make it about motion control and weird controllers and, you know, you launch it with minigame collections, I don't think you're really getting the message across that this thing is a giant shift from what you did last time, and the people who wrote off the Wii really need to give this thing another chance because it's a fresh start.
Yeah.
I mean, so to me right now, the Wii U sales situation obviously is bad, but, you know, at this point in the 3DS's life cycle, it wasn't good either.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not terribly worried about sales at the moment. I want to see.
I definitely think it can be salvaged, and the discussion of how to do that is for another day.
Well, and that's kind of what I'm about to get at. I want to see what happens after the current holiday season, because if you know, they come out of E3 and we're like, well, damn, they've got stuff lined up to ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if. I'll be honest, there's not a console seller on the Wii U. The only core property they've released on Wii U is another fucking new Super Mario Brothers game. And I don't think that is a viable space for them to occupy. Now,
right.
So, well, I mean, what we've seen them do, and you know, I don't doubt that Iwata is part of this, is because, I mean, he is at his heart a game developer. Which is a very weird position for him to be a CEO of a company that he really wasn't, you know, I mean, he was a HAL guy. The fact he made it to CEO of Nintendo is pretty weird.
Yeah, he's a quasi-outsider.
He really is. I mean, in some of his interviews with Miyamoto, it comes up, he sort of viewed himself as a Miyamoto rival who was soundly beaten every time he tried to do anything. The fact they brought a guy from HAL, I mean, he wasn't at HAL when they promoted him. They brought him over a couple years earlier, I think. I mean, but not a really long time earlier.
Yeah, they brought him over and made him one of the directors or vice presidents.
I mean, and then suddenly he's CEO. It was weird. I mean, I think it was Johnny, you were saying, like, he was just walking around E3 before he became CEO or something ridiculous like that?
Oh, yeah. No, I saw him drunk at the Nintendo party the night before they announced it.
Which is so weird. That, I mean, how Nintendo is it that they announced it during E3? Like, that's not – you would think they'd want him to be in Japan when they announce it, but no. No, we'll just
It was very weird coming off Yamauchi, but I mean, we've had this conversation
before.
But, I
mean, I'm going with this, though, is, you know, I want to see – I mean, they've made some announcements recently, you know, their development platform about making it really easy for these smaller publishers to get their games on Wii U. I mean, they sort of stealth launched the Nintendo web framework on us when they put out the Google Maps thing. I'll be curious, you know, what this does for the platform on these really small tokenized sales. You know, they'll be able to get lots of these smaller things on there to maybe make them a viable eShop with high returns on relatively low investment.
But that's not going to turn around the fortunes of the platform.
No, but it's a shift. I'm seeing these little shifts in the company, and I wonder, you know, with no platform sellers out there, if they go full blast on us, can they get enough consoles out there that these other little shifts become magnified and actually represent a new strategy for them? Because right now, they just seem like you're painting a ship that it has a big hole in it.
Yeah, I think things will get interesting once the PS4 comes out, because Sony is the kind of company that, I mean, Japan, they're not going to, Xbox 720, whatever it's going to be called, that thing's not going to sell in Japan. PS4 could sell in Japan.
I don't know.
It's definitely going to sell in the West.
That remains to be seen in Japan. But in the interest of just wrapping this up so we can finish up Ease, I just want to say that even on top of the poor sales and the anemic releases on Wii U this time of year, this is the easiest time of the year to be negative about Nintendo. And it's actually a cyclical thing. It happens every year in April and May. Because in the period before E3, Nintendo is so silent. We literally don't know a single game they're going to release this holiday season. Not one. And so they're so obtuse right now about their plans because they're waiting for E3. I don't know that that's a good strategy, but that is their strategy. That it feels like nothing's on the horizon.
Right.
Like, and the things that you know that are on the horizon, like a new Mario, a new Zelda, a new Mario Kart, are so amorphous, you know, that, and they haven't
Vaporware, even... you could call it.
I wouldn't, but you could.
There will be a Smash Brothers game. Well, gee, thanks.
You know, it's hard to take a whole lot of, a lot of heart from knowing that, yes, those things, of course, are going to come, but until you show me that, it's hard for me to get excited. And so among the enthusiast community, as such as we are, it's very easy to get down in the dumps this time of year. And I've seen it happen every year, and I see it in myself too. So I'm not blaming anyone else for feeling this way. I think there are economic realities on Iwata that are bad, and I think his future at the company is in danger.
I don't think it's over yet.
No. And I think there are multiple opportunities, and E3 is the next big one. So I'm not writing him off. I love the guy. He's adorable. But I do think the question of whether he's a good CEO is up in the air right now. I think his legacy is yet to be written.
I just don't feel the company is paying that guy to have the Wii U tanking worldwide and not having games out for 4 months.
But you know,
he's got to be feeling the pressure.
I still don't quite understand his role at the company. I mean, he seems to have a lot of time on his hands. I mean, he's busy being journalists. I don't know what he does. I wouldn't be surprised at all if his title is more title than substance.
I sometimes I do feel like he's spending so much time scrubbing the decks that I wonder who's actually steering the ship.
That's what I'm wondering. But, I'm wondering if
he's so invisible.
Like, I just have to wonder with some of the strategic moves that they've made or not made, I have to wonder if he is somehow at the whim of the NCL board or something like that.
Could be. I think they are a pretty powerful board. That's something that we really don't have any insight into. So we're going to have to wrap it up, guys. Sorry, it's a big, big topic, but we have a lot to cover this episode. So I hope people found that interesting, and I hope we have incited some conversation. Hopefully respectful, thought-provoking conversation. So, John, are you going to head out now?
Yeah, I'm going to head out now. Enjoy your discussion of Ease. I never actually did get to play Ease. I remember back in the day for Turbo CD when I had my TurboGrafx-16, another ill-fated...
Why did you have a TurboGrafx-16?
I did. I had a TurboGrafx-16 when I was young and silly in the 60s.
What the fuck?
When you see Keith Courage in action, man, you've got to get your hands on that.
Legendary Axe, shut up, all of you.
So you're going to go play your Jaguar now.
James, the answer is that there's nothing wrong with experimenting a little when you're in college.
or in elementary school in my case. But, when I was when the in the time of the TurboGrafx-16, the Turbo CD came out, and I will say that Ease was the big game. It blew everybody's minds. You know, it's audio and.
It was big at the time.
So definitely enjoy your conversation of it.
Thanks, man. Yep. We will talk to you next week.
You bet.
See you later. All right, guys. So we're going to move on now to Retroactive. It's been a long time coming, but we're finally going to talk about Ease Book 2 and the conclusion to our feature on this sort of this twofer pack. And I don't think it's going to take as long because Ease Book 2 really is very similar to Book 1.
When we last left our heroes, they were comparing it to Australia and evolutionary dead ends.
Yeah, we had a great discussion about it last time. You know, I asked Alex when we were at PAX if he was interested in playing Book 2 to come back and do it again, and he said no.
Which is fair.
He did not enjoy Book 1 very much, not as much as the rest of us did. So Book 2 is no less fascinating, I think, than Book 1, but it mostly is interesting in the same ways.
Right.
James actually beat it earlier today. I got pretty close to the end, and I think Guillaume made it roughly halfway through.
Yep. Yeah, I'm about like 80 pages into Book 2 or something.
Yeah, we've all seen a substantial chunk of the game at the very least. You know, it is a very smooth transition from Book 1 to Book 2. And
you may not even realize it's happened.
Yeah. And in fact, I don't think there's any way to skip directly to Book 2. I don't know that that's even possible.
Not without a passcode, no.
Okay, yeah.
But you do know that you've made the switch once you save, and then all of a sudden, all your previous saves become Ease, Book 1.
Yep.
Right.
They've all been retitled. Point.
So, you know, the major changes, I guess, in Book 2 are that, you know, the graphics are a little bit nicer. The music's probably a little more varied, the soundtrack, maybe a little higher fidelity, I think, because the game originally, Book 1 and 2 were released separately for computers in Japan. And so Book 2 is the later game. It was made at least a year later, maybe 2 years later. And it is kind of an evolutionary step. Probably the biggest change of all is that they added the magic system.
Yep.
Do you guys want to take a crack at explaining
system? Oh, I'll explain the fucking magic system. What happens is Adol, our hero from the first game, and he transitions well into the second game, stumbles around for the first, I don't know, hour and a half of the game. And then he kind of fumbles into this, I guess the best way of describing it is it's just a chest. He opens up a chest, and in there is, I want to say they just call them the magic of fire, which is weird. But essentially, in that particular, it's another thing you can equip. So if you remember, before it was sword, armor, shield, I think that was it.
And then the ring.
And then the ring, right. Yeah. So the ring has been replaced with these magics. And as you go throughout the game, much like you did with the rings, you continue to collect magics of whatever. Some of them are stupid bullshit and don't really do much of anything. Some of them, like fire, are pretty much the only thing you'll ever use. So the fire one is the first one you get. It basically lets you shoot fireballs out and essentially completely breaks the combat system of the game. Because
I think it's a pretty massive change in the way that you play the game, especially bosses.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean,
and like it's super weird that when you cast fireballs, you have to shoot out like 10 fireballs for 1 point to go down.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You'll never run out of magic in this game.
Well, not from using that wand. There are other wands where you will, and I'll touch on one of them a little bit later because I'm probably the only one who got it. So that's sort of the primary, the default, what you'll have equipped the majority of the time. The others, there's one that transforms you into I can't remember what they call themselves now all of a sudden. Not goon.
Goons, yeah.
Yeah, it is goon. Transforms you into like a rabbit goon so you can wander around a part of the stage in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
Which is super useful until you're about three levels higher and then it becomes situationally useful. Basically, it's like, I want to talk to this goon and know what he thinks about the world. Not really. They're mostly going to say stupid shit to you, and you're going to keep go on with your life.
This ability to talk to the monsters is actually kind of funny, you know? And it's not something that you see in a lot of games. And they have reflections about you as, like, the hero. You know, like, they'll say something like, oh, some red-haired punk named Adol is just, or Adol, you know, try to kill me earlier. I'm going to get that guy, you know?
Oh, I mean, some of them, they're more reflexive than that. They're like, I bet he's around right now. Oh, I'm worried.
Hey, James.
Yeah.
Can you think of another game where you transform into different characters and talk to people to get them to reveal things to you?
I don't know, Johnny. What game are you leaning me towards?
I was thinking of Crystalis.
Yeah, go figure. Oh, that, yeah.
You even use a magic spell to do it.
Yeah. Now you just have magic of. I mean, some of the other ones, there's the magic of light, which, as far as I know, gets used a handful of times and is more or less useless garbage.
Okay, can you tell me what it does? Because I still haven't
figured
it out. So
there's a chest at one point in the game you have to use it to reveal.
Yeah.
It's sort of flickering, and it's not any time close to when you got said magic.
It's it's much later.
Okay.
So, I mean, I had no reason to know to use it there. I'm just going through everything. I'm like, fuck this chest. And then all of a sudden, hey, the chest is here. I don't know.
Yeah. The main use of the light magic is that when you're in the mines, it will indicate places where you can go up or down, especially down that aren't obvious otherwise. So it's a problem. Yeah, it was a big problem in Easebook 1 because there's a place in the cave or in the abandoned mine in that game that is very hard to find because it's just not visually indicated that you can go through there.
Right.
And you have to go through there to beat the game. So it's like eventually you're like just kind of ramming into the walls looking for something and you might accidentally go through it or you go and check a map on the internet. so that there's that stuff in Book 2 as well. But once you find the magic, it uses your magic points constantly, but you generally have a lot of them.
Right.
And anytime you have it equipped, if there is one of those places, if there's a break in the wall where you can go through, it will kind of glow and give you a better indication that you can walk through there. Again, it's really kind of optional because
I never used it.
You can learn to identify those things just by the shape of the walls.
Yeah.
And so you can learn to navigate the caves without that. But it could be useful for some people if you have a hard time telling those places.
Yeah, I mean, so the only time
But of course, the game never actually tells you what any of the magics do. They leave it to you to figure it out. And that in particular is a very specific use case for a magic spell. And you could easily turn it on all the time and never figure out what the hell it does. So it's pretty annoying in that way, you know, and a lot of the inventory items are the same thing.
The only time you have to use that spell is that one chest. That's it. That's the only time in the game. And that's
which you will probably figure out through process of elimination.
That's exactly what I did. I went through my items that made sense. I went through spells. I shot it with fireballs for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I don't think I meant to deliberately select that one. I think I was going to transform, thinking maybe only goons can get to it. And then I hit that one, and all of a sudden it materialized. I'm like, all right, what the fuck happened? And I opened it up.
I was trying to use the mirror on it.
I did do that, yeah. And I think I had the silver pendant. I think I tried to use that. I mean,
that's one reflection that I had while playing the game. I think that if I had played this much younger, when I was much younger, I would have not understood at all what I was doing with these items. Like there is this sequence where you are in an underground cave and there's lava everywhere, and all of a sudden there's like poisonous gases, and you have to choose a leaf,
yes,
a leaf to get through that. And I assume that you're like breathing through the leaf, you know, like to filter out the noxious gases.
But if I had
been a kid, like the
you are
like,
yes. I believe one character actually tells you that you can use one of these leaves to get through it, but it's
that's a case where the game is unusually explicit in how to solve the puzzle because when you go to the demon village, the secret demon village, which you have to figure out that you would use the evil bell in order to make them come out, which was did not make very much sense to me
at all.
Yeah,
that's the part that's just insane.
Like, right, the hard part. But once you do that, the guys in that little tunnel will tell you exactly how to finish pretty much the entire rest of that whole region of the game. They'll tell you the answers to all the puzzles.
Oh, you see, I don't think I never used a bell in that
section. I wouldn't have thought of it either. I knew there was something there, but I couldn't figure out how to make them appear. Yeah. And yeah, you have to ring the bell because the bell summons demons. Yep. You know,
Adol keeps saying he's being watched and he thinks it's demonic. I mean, he just says that as you walk through that area.
Oh, geez.
Like they are clues, but they're bad clues.
Yeah,
but there's another one where it's like where it tells you that that you can hear people talking. Well, unless you thought to check what the earrings do, which you equip it and then you hit the button and it kind of gives you this really slowly displayed text about what the item does every single time. It tells you can hear things that are really faint. That's the only reason I didn't put the earrings on there. I was like, yeah, I'll put it on. Because earrings obviously make it so you can hear better.
So, yeah, like that's another big flaw of the inventory system. Like you can usually equip them and press B or 1 on the Wii Remote, and it will sometimes tell you what the item does when you use it at the wrong place. But there's also consumable items, so you're always running the risk of just using up an item when you don't want to.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about like the
it does ask you if you want to use it.
Yeah, but I mean the thing is. It's to me, it was always the fact that you hit it by accident, and now you have to watch that slow explanation come up again about how pickaxe works.
Right.
I think the pickaxe one
it does its job well.
It does its job well. It's like, fuck you, game. Awesome. But I mean, a lot of these one-time use items are really just Deus Ex Machina to get you to go to a place and then come back. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really all they're there for. At the end of the game.
I think the term is MacGuffin, though.
Yeah, well, fine. At the end, there's a particularly egregious one that is literal Deus Ex Machina. It is a thing that is a god inside it. And you wander from one side of the world to get it because another god tells you to get it. Come back, only for them to tell you, yeah, actually, it's busted. You need to go get something else. Now, even though all of this stuff was within walking distance of them to start with, and like, fine, go back and give it somewhere else. And you have to go somewhere else. For them to tell you, first off, you have to remember who had this item a long ass time ago in the game. And then that person says, oh, I lost it. And you're like, so, oh.
What you're saying is that I should really be looking up codes for the end of the game and just.
Yeah, pretty much. So basically, you walk around this village after one dude lost it, if you remembered who had it to begin with. And then somebody goes, oh, yeah, I think a dude in a cloak picked it up. He might have been a demon. And you're like, well, great. Awesome. Thanks, game. What does that mean? You go into the demon place, and then the guy's like, oh, yeah, I saw some dude. He had something in his hand. He went that way. It's like, the game just – this is extreme endgame stuff. The game's just like, yeah, fuck you. I want to make this stuff go longer. And it does stuff like this where it kind of gives you a hint, but it's not much to go off of. And
yeah.
And I know that, you know, people there's a certain argument Guillaume was having it earlier. Games hold your hand too much. This is what you got away from. So I don't want to hear you say it anymore.
This is the alternative.
Because this shit used to be
really
widespread.
There are games.
There is a middle ground.
Yeah.
My Lost Secret Castle is a thing. And that proves hand-holding is important.
No, but this game just likes to hide stuff and not show it. Like
that happens, but I mean,
there's like many items that are vital, such as the leaf that I talked about earlier, that are just underground in some random spot.
Okay, it's not even in a chest. You just step on it.
I mean, you can see it.
Yeah, it's on the ground. It's
in the artwork. I mean,
what?
You don't know what it is, but you can tell there's something there that you haven't seen before.
The rodenuts are the same way. They're just on the ground. You're like, what's that thing? Oh, it's a nut. Okay, cool.
Okay. Yep. If you say so, I couldn't see them. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of give some context around the game, you know, we got here talking about magic. You know, the fire magic really does change how the game plays. I mean,
yeah, actually, there's a forum quote from Toshiro Nico. And this person just said, if I had to describe the difference between book 1 and book 2, I would say take 1 and just add a fireball that plows through everything.
Yeah. So late in the game, John, you've probably hit this point. Guillaume probably hasn't. The fireball basically just turns into a stampeding force of death.
Oh, it has for me.
I wasn't sure at what point exactly that happened because I wasn't using the fireball very much at the time. But apparently it's when you get the idol of the hawk.
Yes.
Apparently that's what does it. But yeah, so before that, the fireball, when you shoot it, it'll hit an enemy and it'll knock the enemy back a little bit, but then the fireball is absorbed or whatever.
Right.
And so you kind of have to hit, you know, you have to throw several of them in order to do very much damage, and it feels not very efficient. Once you get that idol, now the fireball gets bigger on the screen, so you can tell there's something about it.
Right.
I'm not sure if it gets more powerful, but it does penetrate enemies, and it also knocks them back. So if the enemy is far enough away from you and it has enough room behind it to get knocked back, a lot of times you can shoot one fireball. It'll keep basically push it. It will plow through just like this guy said. It will push the enemy back and keep hitting it over and over again
until
it hits it. And you can kill almost the most powerful non-boss enemies in the game. As long as they're in a hallway that's long enough, you can shoot one fireball, which uses less than one magic point out of
like
hundreds
yes.
that you would have at that point. And the fireball will not blast through that enemy all the way until they die. And if any other enemies are nearby and they get caught in it, it'll kill them too. So it becomes ridiculously powerful.
There's a part at the end of the game in the area known as the Goddess's Castle, I think is the term they use for it.
Mm-hmm.
And right out, so the Goddess's primary shrine, you get free heal, free max magic, whatever. And then there's just two long pathways. Now, the trick with the fireball is you have to keep the fireball on screen, because once it leaves the screen, it stops, and any enemies it was dragging along with it are no longer going to take any damage. Mm-hmm. But it's just a long corridor where, like, three enemies spawn at a time on each side. So you throw it and just walk down the hall with the fireball as it picks up enemies and kills them one at a time. Turn around, and there's three right behind you. Just throw it again. And just follow it to the edge until it dissipates, then turn around, and it's like a free experience machine.
Well, I'm glad that the magic is actually useful, because I find that, you know, like when we discussed the book one, we said that there was a major difference when you level up and like the strength of your attacks, and this was toned down so much in book two. I find that, you know, I upgraded, you know, from the first sword to the last one that you could get in the first village, and I didn't really see any difference. Like, the enemies didn't seem to go down any faster. I was like, what was the point?
They tamped down the swing of improvement considerably.
Yeah.
Now, what's funny
is... I think it's partly because you're expected to use the magic. I think you're expected to bring that in, and so the differences in armor and swords are not as... And even level ups are just not as noticeable.
Right. Yeah. Now, where that becomes an issue is in boss battles, where in the past you say, oh, just gain two levels, you'll be fine. In boss battles, especially the second to last one, cakewalk, but the last one and maybe like two from the end, gaining levels doesn't really make a huge difference.
It comes down more to skill and approach. And most of the bosses are defeated using the fireball.
Yep. In fact, many of them can't take damage unless you use the fireball. There's one where you just stand in front of it.
It allows them to kind of design the encounters differently than the bosses in the first game. And you know, although they're still very simple, at least they're different. And for the most part, I felt the boss battles were better in this game.
There's a couple where the strategy is just stand in front of him and spam and hope you have enough health to survive. Like that.
Yeah, but most of them require a little more management than that. They require you to wait for certain, you know, animations that show that they're vulnerable, or they require you to move around and dodge things while you're trying to shoot fireballs at them. So we have a quote from the forums from Rodrigue, who wrote that the bosses in this game are a lot more fun though. I don't feel the same kind of power curve as in the first game, and it almost always takes me a half dozen attempts to beat a boss. So it's neither too easy nor too hard. Regular enemies, though, are the same. In book one, I would level up and suddenly kill every enemy on the field in one hit. They're more durable here.
Yeah, I think the fireball sort of breaks the shit out of everything, though. I mean, it's sort of a ridiculous...
It kind of does, but I kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with it, but it definitely breaks the game a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, so, to speak somewhat bemusingly is that some of the stuff in the late game, you could tell they sort of. So there's one spot early in the game where you have to go back into these mines, and you have to give the books to these statues, and the last statue you have no clue where it is, and the game doesn't tell you, hey, stop looking for the statue, it's not here. You just have to give up, essentially, and that's essentially how I just gave up. To forget it.
Yeah,
I'm tired of this. And about 20 minutes later, when you go back to the village, all of a sudden there's actually a doorway to get to there. That again, you'd have to kind of know to use this one random item in this one random place that you'd have no reason to suspect is there, which is you go into the basement of some dude's house and ring a bell, and suddenly a portal to hell opens up.
And about 100 enemies emerge from the wall.
And then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. but it's a cool scene, though.
It's
like
is.
You see the wall crumbling down. It's incredibly well animated for the time.
Yeah, the funny part is that spot gave me all the crap you could buy in that town. Because I didn't leave until I had so much cash. I was like, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Just keep giving me the dollar signs, son.
Yeah, it's begging to be farmed.
Oh, it's so ridiculous. But the farming doesn't work as well in this game as it did in the previous game. So it's kind of funny.
It's just not as effective. It doesn't overpower you like it would in Ease Book 1.
Yeah, and in late game stuff, which I just had to deal with, there's nowhere to farm. Because the enemies, at the very last few stages of the game, you're basically retreading old territory. So there's there's nobody that really gives you any experience. So you're kind of like, all right, well, I guess I got to deal with this stuff. So the trick is, kids, there's that spot at the end of Ease 1 I pointed out on the show. Just grind all the way to max level there, then go to Ease Book 2. Just beat the game like it doesn't have any idea what's going on. It'll be fine.
So we need to wrap up in a minute, but I wanted to get through a couple more forum comments. And of the people who actually made it into Book 2 and left comments about it, there was a very common theme and a very popular topic, which was the level design. It's something we haven't really talked about yet. We talked about it some last time with Book 1. But there was kind of a debate over whether the level design is better or worse or the same in Book 2. Fjurbanski, I think he corrected us, it's F.J. Urbanski.
Yes.
Said that Book 2's level design is certainly better than Book 1's and doesn't need a map system nearly as much. Whereas Pixelated Pixies, who I think actually beat both games here and is one of the superstars of the thread, posted a lot of really interesting commentary. Definitely worth go read everything he put in there. But he said, I have to say, having started Book 2, the lack of any sort of map feature is becoming a huge problem, particularly where I am currently, which is the mine area. And And goes on to say, not all games designed around exploration require maps, but when the level design is this generic, indistinct, and dare I say it, bad, then a map truly is necessary.
I mean, it's really egregious, because when this was a separate game from Book 1, this was your intro to Book 2.
Yep.
This is how you were introduced. One of the most labyrinthian things I've ever seen in a video game.
Yeah, it's just like you enter a small cave, there's the door you came from, one other door that you can enter. So, okay, that's fine. So you go from door to door. Oh, all of a sudden there's two more doors, and then three more doors. And it's just like, what the hell?
And you know, like
it's almost like
insane.
A choose your own adventure book.
Yeah, so like you have to basically like give them numbers and just, you know, okay, I went through 1-1-2-1-2, and I'm gonna 1-1-2-1-2-3. You know, it's just like you have to what do you call that? There's a term for it.
It's a depth first search.
You're sort of indexing it. I mean,
yeah,
I did it all in my head, but I definitely took a lot of wrong turns. Like I would have a destination in mind. Maybe I'm going back to a place to try to fight a boss that I couldn't beat before. And I would have a vague idea of the sequence of doors I need to go through to get there. But then I would forget a step and I'd end up going the wrong way and I'd get lost and I have to warp back. Or, you know, like it's so easy to get lost. Even if you kind of grasp loosely the way the different sections are connected, it's just way, way too intricate. And the art doesn't change enough from one room to the next to help you remember.
No.
What's the correct door to take?
And to me, that part is really bad, and it was really frustrating because I alluded to it earlier, looking for these statues so you can give them the books you collected in the first game. and one of them is just not there. It's you just can't get to it. It's not in that part of the level. There's nothing
right.
to tell
that's,
you.
That's when you have to go to the basement.
Like, yeah, there's nothing to tell you it's not there.
And, right. And, I mean, I totally, like, spent a lot of time wandering around the mines thinking, I must have missed something. I feel like I've gone through every door, and yet I still have this one book.
Oh,
so,
I just started with a map that that Pixelated Pixies posted.
The last book's not here. Stop looking.
And I already know that, like, the chapter art for this is going to be the map for this first cave. And, you know, people, you can look at that on your iPods and see what bullshit it is.
I mean, that's not even the most egregious part to me. The most egregious part is when you're going to go raid the boardroom meeting. Over at what's that area called?
The Solomon Shrine.
Solomon Shrine. Yeah. I mean, so you're busting into Solomon Shrine disguised as a goon. Well, I guess you technically are a goon, which is where the leader of this whole bullshit operation is currently housed himself in what is the worst laid out office park ever.
That whole sequence was reprised many years later in one of the Dragon Quest games. I want to say it was 5.
I don't.
Do you remember
5.
Guillaume? It's at the very end of one of those middle trilogy Dragon Quest games where you go to the demon's castle and you have to like put on a disguise or use a magic spell and you're going around and like talking to all the demons, you know, and they start to suspect.
It might have been 6
not...
actually.
5 or 6, yeah. It's anyway, I just realized that as you were talking about it.
I mean, like, you're having to go get like a company ID card so you can go through gates. I mean,
yes.
This is like, only to find out you can't fight the boss right now because he's in a meeting. He's in a fucking meeting. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Game, what are you doing?
It's honestly, it's funny, and it's supposed to be funny.
I like, know, but it's just so bizarre, and that level layout is so bullshit, and you're just, and it's enormous, and everything looks the same, and there are doors everywhere.
Speaking of funny, and perhaps like unintentionally so, I don't know, but when you, sorry, I'm going back to what's it called? The fire, the Burnland or
Burnland. Yeah.
Yeah. In Burnland, when you rescue the little kid,
yeah,
the little kid, like suddenly you hear a voice like, oh, voice acting. Cool. And it's pretty good voice acting, I guess. But then the kid says, hey, can you help me? I'm the son of, bridge guy or bridge guard. And I was just like, what? That's how you call your dad?
I guess he's giving you something to contextualize who he is, because everybody
sure,
in this game tells
know.
You their name every time you meet them.
Well, yeah, like
every,
you already
every
know
conversation
that...
in Ease begins with, my name is blank.
Yeah, this guy is Kudo. It's not
hey,
bridge guard.
It's me, blank. Do you remember me? Yes! We just talked 5 minutes ago, Keith! God damn it!
Well, on the subject of the story, I have one final forum comment from NoName2200, a frequent retroactive contributor, and he said, the plot actually has lots of verisimilitude, and it's actually quite elaborate, which becomes more apparent towards the end when it ties to the events of Book 1. But
that's
it definitely
bullshit.
Has several...
That's just bullshit! I just beat the game, and that is bullshit!
But it definitely has several what moments. While I appreciate that less can be more, especially in RPGs, their storytelling definitely had room for improvement.
So I'm gonna minorly spoil something here. At the very end of the game, you get to the room that the final boss is in. I mean, he's behind this door. All of a sudden, it's Cameo City in there. You spent the last 6 hours just getting your ass handed to you, trying to get to this door, and suddenly a back door opens up, and everybody from the first game just strolls the fuck on in. Like, sup, man?
Come,
good to see
they've
you.
Come to, they've come to pray for you and give you their power as you battle the final
One
boss.
Dude brings a harmonica. He's like, I've got a harmonica. Here you go. It's like, dude, the fuck? Why didn't you bring an army? You brought a harmonica?
It's Something Wicked This Way Comes all over again.
One dude brings a shield and the other brings a harmonica. It's like, I haven't seen you in a whole game and this is how you decide to come with the
Another
harmonica?
Another one brought frankincense and myrrh.
And the best part is, it's not even the dude who you found the harmonica for in the first game. It's a different person.
I'd like to think that he beat up and murdered Lair the poet and stole the silver harmonica so that he could travel across the universe on a comet just like you did to bring it to you in the Solomon Shrine.
So Lair shows up, but only in the credits, because why not? And the other girl with the blue hair, I'm trying to remember her name.
I don't remember.
Fina. She shows up at the very end, because sure. And she's like super important, and then she's like, what the fuck, hey, what are you doing?
The way the game handles characters is definitely weird.
Well, considering I think that it actually needs to reintroduce you to Fina, because you haven't seen her in a whole game and a half.
You know, instead, it's just like,
hey, here's Fina, what's up?
Like, we were discussing the legacy of Ease and, you know, the its influence. I think that perhaps this explains a lot about Twilight Princess.
Nice. I need like a family tree for the characters in Ease, because like there's some bullshit going on where they're like, oh yeah, I'm actually the descendant of the priest fact. I'm like, fuck you, no you're not. Couldn't you have mentioned that like 8 hours ago? It's like, oh, you have magic blood. Don't you think that could have been useful before I crawled my ass through a sewer to get here? He's like, no, I just sat on this piece of information. It's your last name, bro. You could have remembered this.
So, as we conclude this retroactive, God, which has certainly been a lot of fun and the source of many, many laughs as we've gone through it, I know it might sound that James is incredibly annoyed by this whole thing. Keep in mind, he's the one of us who actually completed the whole thing.
Oh, I love this game, but it is the most effed up RPG I've ever played. I mean, it just takes conventions like, oh, fuck us, I don't care.
It's a bizarre experience, that's for sure.
It's like there are moments where they deeply cared about a character, so they gave us a 9-minute soliloquy at the end of the game where she talks about how you should remember her as a girl and not as a god. What?
Oh my god.
But then in the credits, you see Adol's dancing with a different girl from the game, and it's like, what the fuck?
He gets around.
What are you doing?
I too have many criticisms of Ease Book 1 and 2, but I have to say, in the end, I have a lot of affection for it, and I really enjoy the moment-to-moment playing of it. I hate when I get stuck, because it makes me feel stupid,
so
and then
bad.
I find out the solution, and it's total bullshit. But when the game, when I am moving through the game, when I'm making it work, I'm really, really enjoying it. Now, Guillaume, I know you've played other Ease games before. How did you feel kind of going back to the roots of the series?
Oh, it doesn't have almost anything in common. It's really, really weird. And so far, I would say Ease 7 remains the only Ease game that I really find good. You do see kind of, you know, like the seed of certain elements. I mean, the whole magic system here is reprised in subsequent games, but in a much more effective way, in a much better way. You know, like they work it into the combat system, which is completely different, of course. I gotta say, I'm very disappointed by the combat overall. Like, it's not at all what I expected it to be. It's a little bit less interesting than I thought it would be. It's kind of addictive in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I don't find it satisfying at all.
Imagine whenever they made the jump from this trample to death combat to like what it is now. Imagine what fans of the series, all five of them, probably did. I mean,
they probably hated it.
I'm sure they did. And I can't imagine. I mean, it's such a weird departure. It's kind of like a certain DS game I threw over my head at a certain panel a certain week and a half ago.
That was a great moment, by the way.
Oh.
Actually, to tell you where they went after this, after book two, they made Ease 3, which was the side-scrolling platformer where you still ram into enemies. Yeah.
Mm.
The combat is still actually very similar, but you can jump. And
this
it's a TV platformer,
is just mental.
But it's also an action RPG. And, you know, the Super Nintendo version is just as weird and confusing and enchanting as these games are, but in a very different format. So I would say if you ever get a chance to play that, I do recommend it. But it is no less confusing and strange than Book 1 and 2.
I kind of wonder if I would have appreciated the DS port more. Because, you know, like, the reviews that I've read seem to say, like, this is not a very good game. But now I realize, well, the original wasn't all that good
game
either. So, you know, maybe the DS game has
some features like a map.
No.
A lot of DS games have maps, so, you know, like perhaps it has some features that would appreciate that would help me appreciate it more.
See, I think me the M.C. Escher painting quality of what goes on in this game, like, it's just complete utter bullshittery where you just sit there and you go, all right, game, whatever, just do whatever crazy shit you feel like doing this morning. I think they probably toned that down in the DS game. They almost have to, like, the complete ham-fistedness of its attempt to tell story. Like, they have to fix that.
But they sure do try, don't they?
They try so hard. So, before the last boss, you go through like 5.5 minutes of people talking at you with their big giant face on screen going, rah, 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 rah. Even the last boss does this bullshit. He talks to you for like 2 minutes, and you're like, I don't care. I want to stab you in the head. And then you come out, and they're all lined up like it's a small world to talk to you. It's like, God, just stop talking. You're not saying anything that makes sense. Like, I bet that's not in the DS game. And I love the fact this game is doing it because it's freaking unbelievable. You just sit there, you're like, what?
It's hilarious.
What in the world are you doing? Oh.
So there you go. We did find a lot of things to like about East Book 1
I just
and 2.
Compared it to It's a Small World. This is
yes, you did. I will never forget that, James. So we do have to wrap up the segment and the episode, but I do want to give a special thanks to everybody who voted in the poll, who played along with the game, and especially who posted in the forum threads, and not only gave us some things to read out on the show and help keep the conversation moving in different directions, but also like really was a big help in just playing through the game, like having people to talk to about what's going on, and, you know, people linking to different game facts and different guides and putting maps in there and trading tips about what does this item do and how did you use this magic. It was actually a really fun experience to play through as a group in that way. And if you end up, you know, being interested by the discussions that we've had about this game and you later on decide to play through, which I think John was saying he might do at some point, I would really strongly recommend that you go seek out the forum thread, the retroactive thread, on Ease Book 1 and 2, and use that as a resource and maybe even post in it and keep it going. I think it's valuable in that way. So thanks everybody for participating. It's the end of the show, so I got a couple plugs. First off, the important one, really important one, we will probably be doing emails next week, and we do still have a lot of great emails in the backlog, but we're always looking for more, and you can send yours to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com or go click in the link in the show notes over at NWR. And just one last note, I just released a new episode of my music show called Discover Music Project. It's about David Bowie, awesome, and my co-host for that episode is Stan Ferguson, awesome, former co-host of this podcast from a long time ago.
A very different podcast that shared a similar name.
Indeed. So anyway, I know there's a lot of love for Stan going way back, and I hope you will go check that out and learn something about David Bowie. And try to get through all the factual errors that we spat. Anyway, you can find that over at crosstalk.com or search for it in iTunes. So that's it. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next week with more John Lindemann and more Radio Free Nintendo.
Awesome.
Yeah.